You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Given the importance that's attributed to the CIA as being so important that it has to remain secret, and so important that if you talk about it, you can go to jail. Everything it's done is so important, and yet nobody knows anything about these things. And that is the result of 70 years of fake news. Americans have no understanding of what their government truly is, because they don't know what the CIA has done. They don't know about how evil the people who serve in Congress and the bureaucracies truly are, because all these evil, illegal things are done by the CIA. The CIA has absolute immunity.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. Today we discuss his latest book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Doug Valentine, good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
William Colby gave you unprecedented access to interview CIA officers in order to write your book on the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Your new book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Why did you title your book The CIA as Organized Crime?
Because everything that the CIA does basically is illegal. And I think of them as the organized crime branch of the United States government. And it's interesting because there's a sort of moral tinge to the title, you know, as if doing something illegal is universally agreed upon as, you know, like a bad thing to do. And I should add that where you enter into a murky moral realm, and I'm not one to defend the CIA, but everybody does illegal things. You know, I mean, I smoked pot for 45 years before it became legal here in the state of Massachusetts. And, you know, all that time, somebody could have, you know, written my biography and called it Doug Valentine as the criminal. You know, I mean, and people do all sorts of illegal things, but it's the extent that of the CIA's illegal actions and it's their impact that make the CIA really a good target of anybody's moral outrage. At the same time, all these things, the CIA does these things illegally because it feels that the American public wants these things done. It just doesn't want to hear about them. Just like Congress authorizes everything that the CIA does. Nothing that the CIA is not a rogue enterprise that is engaging in all these kind of illegal activities, which I chronicle and categorize in excruciating detail in the book. Everything from drug trafficking and arms trafficking to overthrowing foreign governments to spying on people to burglaries to extortion, blackmail. Any kind of crime at all, they engage in on a massive industrial scale. But Congress doesn't want to hear about it. And in fact, Congress has very gratefully passed lots of laws that make it illegal for anybody to blow the whistle. on the CIA's crimes. And the media, through its arrangements with the CIA, does everything it can to cover up the crimes and not tell you about them, on the assumption that the public is too sensitive to know about these things, or that it's in government engages in these kind of industrial scale illegal activities, which are said to never affect America, that these illegal things that they engage in are too horrible for you to know about, and if you knew about them, it would upset you. So you're not told about them, and you're told that none of this affects you personally, that all these illegal things that are being done overseas, for example, and they're being done for your benefit. Well, that's a really big lie, and it's hard to disprove it if you can't actually document all these illegal things that the CIA is engaged in, because there's laws against talking about them. There's laws against naming CIA officers. If you name a CIA officer, you can go to jail. If you talk about CIA sources and methods, you can go to jail. So, before the laws were passed in 1982, making it illegal to name CIA officers, there was still an agreement between the media and the CIA that they wouldn't talk about it, so that these illegal operations could continue and go on all the time. But we've entered a new phase, which is sort of symbolized by the election of Donald Trump and now the discussion of what's called fake news, which is sort of characterized as a new development, as if there hadn't always been fake news. But what I've been telling you for the last 10 minutes here is that Americans have been subject to fake news throughout steadily and relentlessly, without any interruption, since the CIA was created. Very infrequently do we learn anything about the CIA, and then we only learn about it ex post facto, when something happens that has to be discussed, and then only in the most vague and general ways, without, again, ever naming any particular CIA officer or explaining anything about their sources and methods. So in this sense, given the importance that's attributed to the CIA as being so important that it has to remain secret, and so important that if you talk about it, you can go to jail. Everything it's done is so important, and yet nobody knows anything about these things. And that is the result of 70 years of fake news. And now we're told some, you know, fake news of the media covering up everything that the CIA has done. Americans have no understanding of what their government truly is, because they don't know what the CIA has done. They don't know about how evil the people who serve in Congress and the bureaucracies truly are, because all these evil, illegal things are done by the CIA, and the CIA has absolute immunity. But it all comes back to us, and it has finally erupted with the election of Donald Trump and this new controversy about fake news. And somehow Americans are now going to confront their secret past and the fact that they've been lied to for 70 years. And everything that used to be hidden is now going to be exposed, and we're going to stand up and look in the mirror and see ourselves for exactly what they are. Well, I got news for you. That ain't going to happen. It's still going on. And as much as people talk about fake news, that in itself is fake. We still haven't gotten anywhere near to an honest, open discussion about what the CIA does. And if it really was doing things that were for our benefit and helped us, then we would be able to talk about it. And if it was only the kind of illegal things that, like me smoking pot for a couple of decades, that really were not harming anybody, then what would be the problem in talking about it? But the mere fact that it is illegal to talk about it, and it is never talked about it, is proof that it is devastatingly awful. And all that devastatingly awfulness, which has been hidden from us for 70 years, affects us in countless ways, not least of which is robbing us of our history and our identity. Everything that the CIA does comes home to haunt us, most especially in the fact that it's secret from us and we don't know what it is.
How did your book, The CIA as Organized Crime, evolve from your study of the Phoenix Program? Or did it?
Well, yeah, it did a lot. And Phoenix is an important thing to understand if you want to understand the CIA, and not only the CIA, but how the security systems of the government function in secret, and how, again, these secret operations affect you in ways that you don't understand, and how these secret operations affect, actually define most people's basic assumptions about what America is and what it represents and what it symbolizes, and they affect people's self-concepts as individuals. After 70 years of living in a world of illusion and raising children to believe these illusions, you know, it's actually integral to our self-concepts and all our basic assumptions. And the Phoenix Program, which I had, you know, this unusual access to, provides a keyhole. It is a system which I was able to document from beginning to end, from its operational realities to its stated objectives, from the very lowest levels to the very highest levels, to show how CIA policy is created, how it's dissembled in front of Congress and the public, and how it really affects people in terms of it being, Phoenix being the ultimate system for providing security for the rich political elite in this country, and how Phoenix becomes the model for not only fighting the war on terror, but for the Department of Homeland Security. And as soon as you have a political figure like Donald Trump, who's willing to pull out all the stops, you can actually, through this kind of Phoenix system that's set up, you can coordinate mass deportations. You can coordinate the prevention of an entire religious class from entering the United States. You can harass it indefinitely. And the security forces which are in place in the Department of Homeland Security are happy to do this. This is what they've been indoctrinated and trained to do, and this is what they've been waiting to do. And as soon as the political climate wants to do it, it can be done, because these systems like Phoenix Program, which is a system, and I explain at length in the book what I mean by system. You know, it's something that's organized and managed, and it has rules and regulations, and it's very cleverly thought out by people who are magna cum laude graduates of Yale University. Very intelligent people put these systems in place, and how those systems, once a political figure like Donald Trump comes along, can be manipulated and used and turned against you. Phoenix was created by the CIA in Vietnam to use to suppress the insurgency there, and not only the insurgency there, but any domestic nationalistic opposition to the puppet government there. And now it's the model for the Department of Homeland Security, and it's going to be used against you, and it's being used against you right now. And if you want to understand how these systems are put in place, then you can read the book and find out. And I should say, another term that's being thrown around a lot, along with fake news, is this idea of a deep state, which I have never used and I would not use, because I don't know what people mean by it. But it seems to be this kind of blank slate that anybody can project anything they want onto it. I think what people mean when they talk about a deep state are these systems like Phoenix that have been put in place, which are so complex that unless you study them like you were going to study anthropology for 4 years at Harvard or the petrochemical industry, you can barely grasp. And so people think that it's somehow secret and hidden from them. But if a person has the time and can study them, then you can understand how these systems work, and you can see how they relate to Congress, to the Department of Justice, the legal system. You can see how they relate to the media. You can see how they relate to foreign operations. And suddenly all these things become clear, and all the things that have been hidden from you appear before you. And it's not, you realize that all the facts had been there all along if you'd only had time to study it and look into it. And you realize, well, there really is no deep state. There's just a lot of things that are beyond what you know. And that if you had the time to study them, you could figure it out. You know, I mean, just like executives at Fox News know what the news is going to be 2-3 weeks from now. They know it's brewing, you know, and then they're not surprised on it like you are when you think it's news and it's a rabbit pulled out of a hat. But the people who run the government are plotting these things 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, 10 years into the future. And the people in the media are just as aware of what the government has planned, you know, as the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So there really isn't a deep state. There really isn't fake news. There's just things you don't know. And don't mythify them and don't make them seem like somehow it's the Wizard of Oz behind, you know, pulling magic tricks. You know, it's all there. You can know it all. It's all very human. It's all very understandable. You just got to devote the time to it and don't get into the mindset of thinking of these people as like somehow they're extra special or something. They've just put a lot of systems in place which are used to control you.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. In other words, then, would you say that the deep state is the state? And the issue is basically that citizens don't understand what our country is.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can make it into a magic show if you know, but that just suits the ruling elite, you know, as if somehow this is all, you know, beyond you, or you can't understand it, or you can't see it. I mean, but that's just not true. I mean, I was a working class kid who, you know, dropped out of college and smoked a lot of pot for a couple of years and liked to drink and was kind of adventurous. And William Colby liked me and he introduced me to a lot of CIA officers and they told me what was going on. And it demythified the whole thing for me. And I'm not saying, well, if I did it, anybody could do it. My situation was unusual. But I can't, having been there and come back, I can tell you there is no mystery to it. The only thing is that the media and your government prevent you from knowing about it. And if you want to know about it, you can. You just got to make them tell you what's going on. And you can do that. You can change laws. But obviously, you got to want to do it bad enough.
Is the CIA being restructured? And if that's the case, what model is the intelligence agency using to reorganize itself?
Well, that's a good question, because it was reorganized in 2015 under Brennan, John Brennan, who was the director of Central Intelligence and was a career CIA officer. And again, and to a large extent, it was modeled on, this reorganization was modeled on the Phoenix program. The Phoenix program was it's complex, but one of the foundation stones for it were there was a Phoenix directorate. When they created the Phoenix program in Saigon in 1967, in the summer of 1967, they set up a Phoenix directorate in Saigon, which was really like the command center. There was also a Phoenix committee above this directorate. And that Phoenix committee consisted of the CIA station chief and a deputy ambassador who ran civil operations and revolutionary development, and a couple of generals, general who ran counterintelligence, general who ran intelligence. And those five guys were like a executive committee that oversaw this directorate. And the directorate had sub-offices in every region, province, and district in South Vietnam. They set them up over about a year. The provinces were like states in the United States, and the districts were like counties. 44 provinces, every one of them had a Phoenix intelligence operations and coordinating center. And in all the districts, there was a district intelligence operations and coordinating center. And down at the district, they ran informant nets and agent nets into the villages and hamlets, and they tried to identify anybody who was against the government, anybody who was aiding the communists, anybody that could be easily blackmailed, the people in the DIACs, they all had different prejudices and business interests, and the whole thing was just so corrupt that they used it as a way of just terrifying the population of South Vietnam into supporting the government. And they would send their reports from the district to the province, and the province would send them to the regions, and the regions would send it to the Phoenix Directorate, where it was all incorporated into computer systems, where everybody in South Vietnam had a profile and were rated on a scale of 1 to 5, whether they were actually a dangerous person or somebody who, at the other end of 5 wasn't too dangerous and should just be extorted and blackmailed and ripped off and terrorized. And, but if you were number 1, then you got killed and put in jail for the rest of your life and tortured. And that was the Phoenix system. Well, before I get to how the CIA was restructured, that's the system that's the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security has a group of senior people in the White House and in the CIA and in the FBI and Congress, and they oversee a Department of Homeland Security, which has an office in Washington. It's like the Phoenix Directorate, and it has a fusion center in every state, and every state brings together, just like these Phoenix intelligence operations and coordinating centers did in Vietnam, brings every law enforcement, military, and intelligence agency, plus all sorts of civilian industrial organizations together, and coordinates all their intelligence, all their spy net, all their informant networks, and targets them against Muslims and Mexicans and people, environmentalists, and anybody who's on the blacklists. And it's the exact same thing. And they've just been waiting to spring into action. And of course, first they're going to get rid of all the undocumented Mexicans, and they're going to get rid of all the Muslims that they can. And then when they're done, they're not going to say, oh, gee, well, our job is done. Let's go home. They're going to keep going and going and going and going until they have created, under Trump, a population that's so terrified of the government will do everything that Trump wants them to do. And the CIA in 2015 reorganized itself the same way under John Brennan. It found that this Phoenix coordinating system, which it had been using as the model for the war on terror and which became the model for Homeland Security, was absolutely the way that it should reorganize itself. And it created around the world a bunch of what are sort of called counterterror centers. And these counterterror centers, I think there's initially set up 15 of them. They're just called centers, but they themselves are modeled on the counterterror center at CIA headquarters. And they function the same way. And they take all these centers, which were activated at the same time as the CIA's latest division. For the first 70 years, it had 4 divisions: intelligence operations, science and technology, and administration. And in 2015, it added a digital innovations division, which is its computer center, which, hacks and keystrokes foreign governments to death without anybody ever noticing it, and spies on foreign corporations, and does everything to Russia and China that the press and Congress are screaming that, Russia and China do to us. Well, I got news for you again. CIA showed everybody the way on how to do that, and now they organize their own division. And so each of those 5 divisions is represented in each of one of these centers, which are in effect like mini CIAs set up all around the world. And they bring together all of the CIA's resources and divisions and branches together in one place. And so they've set up like these coordinating centers around the world. And apparently, there is some rumors that there was so much objection to these centers being set up by career CIA officers, who are now found themselves outside of these centers. I mean, the centers can only incorporate so many personnel, that the establishment within the CIA was actually objecting to them. And a lot of people now are in the CIA are hoping that the CIA will disband these centers, which focus power in fewer hands, just like capitalism itself. And in that sense, they're a weapon for political people to use. You know, a political person like a Trump in a White House can now reach into these centers in a way that they could never get through the regular CIA bureaucracy before. And instantaneously look at all the intelligence in, say, China or Russia, and instantaneously launch an operation to do something, whether it's a computer operation or a paramilitary operation or intelligence operation. And you saw Trump try to do it in Yemen, you know, within a few days of being elected. And of course, that was a disaster. But anyway, there's a lot of opposition to this new organization in the CIA. A lot of old career people who feel like they're just going to be left on the outside and not have any say anymore.
Well, if this reorganization of the CIA took place in 2015, then obviously it took place under the Obama administration. So it seems to me that this is a sort of a seamless operation, be it Trump, Obama, whoever is in there, right?
Well, you know, in a sense it is. In a sense of this is the arc, the way things have been developing. But at the same time, you know, when you try to change a massive bureaucracy, there's always resistance from within for the reasons that I was talking about. Like the CIA has had systems in place for 70 years. And in the name of streamlining and highly bureaucratizing and being more efficient, these centers were put in place. But again, it threatened the power of a lot of people who are in the bureaucracy itself. So in one sense, it's seamless. But in the, you know, in the other sense, it's really revolutionary. And of course, the power of computer geeks, you know, I mean, it's like everybody's in shock because all the kids who were, you know, unpopular in high school and retreated into the science lab became computer geeks. Well, now all of a sudden they're in charge, you know, and it's like all the paramilitary guys and the spy guys who used to be like these, you know, the James Bond types are being put out to pasture by these young 25-year-old kids like Ed Snowden, who know how to, you know, take down a government just simply by using a computer to completely disable its power grid, for example. You know, in the old days, the CIA used to have to sneak a paramilitary team into southern China in order to try to blow up a power station. Now you can have a computer geek like Ed Snowden just, you know, hack into their power grid and you can take down half the country. So the very nature of the spy business is changing, although obviously the paramilitary people are still very important, as we see by, you know, when you want to overthrow like Syria, you know, you still need intelligence people to work with ISIS and you still need paramilitary people to give them guns and show them how to use them and stuff like that, you know. So certainly the violent, illegal things that the CIA does, and which it is better at doing than anybody. It has its own secret army that just goes around the world, you know, killing and maiming and burning and subverting. You know, it's still the best in the world at doing that. But at the same time, the times are changing and the geeks are, you know, growing in power within the CIA. And so, you know, it's hard to talk about it as a human thing. But I suppose the CIA is in much turmoil internally as America, you know, is today itself through all these changes. It, you know, has these systems in place which are supposed to minimize any kind of changes that affect the rest of the country. The CIA and the military, they're more highly systematized, and so that's supposed to protect them. And it probably does protect them to some extent, but at the same time, they are going through changes and being affected by all the stuff that's going on, all the craziness that's going on.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, let me ask you this. Donald Trump was elected president. Who elected the CIA? Now, your own book is called The CIA as Organized Crime. So we're talking about an intelligence agency that operates illegally and is undermining the elected president and his what he at least stated all throughout the time he was running. He said he wanted better relations with Russia. It seems to me that the intelligence agencies are trying to keep this Cold War with Russia going. That's what it looks like to me.
You know, I could see, I know most everybody I know sees it that way. And yet, you know, it's rhetoric. I don't know how else to explain it to you guys. People are saying things. It's rhetoric. You know, I mean, they're stated, you know, Trump says, I have better relations with Russia. Well, how the hell do you know that it's true? I mean, every other word that comes out of this guy's mouth is a lie. He says, well, I'm going to build a wall along, you know, Mexico, and Mexicans are going to pay for it. And, I mean, he says there's one outrageous, crazy thing after another, which are totally unrealistic. And yet everybody chooses to believe that somehow when he says, I want better relations with Russia, that he's telling you the truth. Now, I don't believe anything that comes out of the mouth of a politician. You know, I mean, they'll say anything to get elected. And maybe somewhere in his heart of hearts, Trump really, really does have a fondness for the Russians and really thinks that the world would be a better place if we all just held hands with the Russians and everybody got along. But I don't believe it, and I have no reason to believe, given everything that he says, that somehow this is really what he wants. And then at the same time, I've been following politics that center around the CIA for 30 years, and I happen to know that stated policies, whatever the politicians state, even if they really stated as absolutely, this is what I'm stating that I want to do, that they have unstated policies all the time that diametrically oppose whatever they're stating as fact. And then that's why the CIA exists, is to further the unstated, illegal operations of the United States. And so as the guy right now, as Trump runs the CIA, he's the president. He got elected. Nobody elected the CIA, but when you elect a president, you're saying we trust you to run the CIA because we couldn't possibly have elections to elect every bureaucrat in the government every 2 or 4 or 6 years. Somebody has to be a president who you can trust to run the CIA. And people elected Trump because they think he's smart enough and he's trustworthy enough to run the CIA. You know, and now he runs it. It's his organization. He can appoint all the senior executives, and he can send his instructions to the new CIA director and say, do this, do that. It's his organization to run. And even if there is resistance, he'll stomp it out, you know, in 3 months or 4 months. And there may be some CIA guys that are bitter, just like there were a lot of CIA guys who were very bitter when Obama got elected. You know, the CIA didn't love Obama. He wasn't some candidate that the CIA had run to become president. They had to adjust for Obama, too. And supposedly, there's always this period of adjustment where a politician who gets elected brings in his people, appoints them to cabinet positions, and reorganizes the government ideologically the way he wants it. And that is what I think we're seeing now, is what happens when any president gets elected and he's replacing Obama and his people have been there for 8 years. And that's all that's happening. There is no overture to make the world a better place. Trump is not engaging in some far-reaching Pepsi commercial to improve Russia relations with Russia and make the world a better place. That, again, is another fantasy.
Well, it seems to me that John Kennedy thought he was running the CIA, and we all saw what happened to him.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always problems, man. You know, and when it comes to the CIA and the fact that it's known that the CIA tries to influence presidential policy, and they're in a unique position to do that. They really are. And they can give a briefing to the president every day. And they can give a briefing about things that is very carefully prepared in order to nudge a president in a particular direction. But if the CIA comes to a president and it says, we want to invade the Bay of Pigs, and we've got it's all set up and we can do it. Just trust us. We're going to do it well. It's still the president's decision. You know, Kennedy said, yeah, go ahead, do it. Just like Trump said yes to this operation in Yemen. And Trump is blaming Obama and the generals and said that this botched SEAL operation in Yemen had been planned before he got to office. And that when he was elected, the generals came to him, along with the CIA, and they said, we've been planning this operation, let's go. And he said, okay, go ahead, do it. Well, you know what? He said yes, and just like Kennedy said yes to the Bay of Pigs, just like Kennedy said yes to starting a secret war in Laos. I mean, he said yes. The CIA might have, you know, certainly came to him and said, we would like to do this. The Russians and the Chinese are moving into this area, and we'd like to keep them out. And so Kennedy said, go ahead and do it. Whether or not the CIA assassinated John Kennedy, you know, I have no evidence that that's what happened, you know, and it's possible that rogues in the CIA did it. I'm not saying it's impossible. I can certainly see where it might have happened. But, you know, as far as I know, nobody's proved that they've done it yet, you know, and they may be really good at covering up stuff, and they may have covered it up so well that nobody ever knows. Maybe they did. I'm not saying they did. However, I don't know that they did either. And if you want to know the sorts of things that the CIA actually does, which have led me to believe that it's the organized crime branch of the United States government, and that it inflicts horrible misery on millions of people around the world, you can read my book and find out all about that stuff. But I don't know about Trump and Russia, and I don't know about the CIA bumping off Kennedy. These things may well be happening, but that's beyond the scope of my knowledge and is things that I haven't researched. And finally, the last thing to say about this is the CIA does, and I explain this in depth in the book, it doesn't work for the average American. Any more than, you know, I mean, all the working class people that I know voted for Trump because they think he's going to help the little guy. Well, I can tell you right now, when the CIA executive officers are sitting around deciding what to do, they're not thinking about helping the little guy. They're thinking about helping the corporations that run this country. And they're like the Rex Tillerson Exxon people. That's the level that the CIA works at. And the CIA considers America not to be 300 million little guys, but the 50,000 people who run this country, who own the corporations, the people in Congress, the generals who sit on the boards of these corporations. The CIA serves those people. It's a capitalist venture designed to enrich the richest people in this country, the people who have enacted the laws that have created the Department of Homeland Security, not to help the little guy, but to preserve their wealth and to increase the police repression in this country. That's the thing you have to understand about the CIA and the systems that have been organized in this country. They're not The systems that have been put in this country aren't there to help you, the little guy. They're to help the 1% or the 1% that decide everything that's going to happen, that decide foreign policy, that decide domestic policy. And every once in a while, you have to put up with people voting every 4 years, you know, and some bomb thrower like Trump can get elected. And then you have to deal with it. But they will deal with Trump, and Trump will be assimilated because Trump is a billionaire capitalist who's been part of this ruling elite all his life. And he may have some unorthodox ideas about Russia, but he will be assimilated. And the military and the CIA and the State Department within a month or two are all going to be perfectly happy with him. And Brian in the House and Mitch McConnell in the Senate will have brought him under control. They'll use him as a stalking horse to get away with his enacting as much repressive Republican legislation as they can, you know, and within the limits of their possibility. But if you want to know how the CIA functions as a tool of the rich ruling capitalist elite, then you can read my book. I don't know anything about Russia and JFK. I wish I did have some insights into that. A bunch of CIA officers I talked to thought that people in the military and the CIA may well, and in the corporate, you know, the corporate bosses may well have assassinated Kennedy. I talked to CIA guys and guys in the DEA who thought that too. But that's because they work. The people that could pull that off work at a level, the same level of the owner as Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox News Corporation. The same level as the people who own the New York Times. The same level as Rex Tillerson that own ExxonMobil. The same level as the people that own the arms industry in this country. Hewlett Packard, the big arms industries, and all the generals on their big lieutenant generals that on their payroll that sit on the boards. 50,000 people, 100,000 people that rule this country. That's where the CIA works. And the CIA, if you talk about it as the CIA wanted to do something, it couldn't do something really all that independently without having some consensus about all these people that are all, you know, at that super capitalist predator Bill Gates level. That's where, and if people wanted to do a public service, make a flow chart, an organizational chart of that group. You know, then you could start seeing where power really flows in this country and see how it's connected to these people are connected to the CIA and the FBI and the military. Then you would start getting a really good understanding of how this country is run and who owns it and how they're using the CIA. But the CIA is not an entity like the Bermuda Triangle that people step into and all of a sudden they're, you know, they vanish. You know, it's got systems and the systems are in controlled by political people like Donald Trump who work within this rich capitalist elite affecting its objectives. And they convince an awful lot of millions of Americans that somehow they've got the little guy's interests in heart. And that's another big lie.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, The Deep State as Fake News. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You know, Doug, I was about to ask you whose agenda or what agenda is it that the CIA is carrying out? And it seems like it would be, particularly with the remarks you've just made, it would be the agenda of say, Wall Street, let's say, the big banks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Goldman Sachs. If you want to know who the CIA works for, look at Goldman Sachs. You know, I mean, these are the people when Franklin Roosevelt created the OSS, which, you know, evolved into the CIA. He didn't go around picking little guys, normal people. You know, these are not the people considered people who have a stake in the United States. You know, they're worker bees who's, you know, if you have to give them Social Security, it's like, my God, you know, so I can't give these people Social Security. I mean, they should be working 50, 60, 70 hours a week for low wages. I mean, that's what Goldman Sachs, things, you know, and those are the people that determine currency rates. And if they think that there's a somehow the currency rate between India and China is devaluing some industry that Goldman Sachs wants to control, well, activate the CIA, go in there, subvert India, you know, have them create some financial crisis, and now all of a sudden the exchange rate is right and Goldman Sachs is happy, and some American corporations can move in. Or, you know, it's hard to separate American corporations because it's all now multinational corporations. You know, I mean, that people think that, you know, trade agreements are somehow anti-American. Well, look at the corporations. You know, I mean, or where do you think Toyota manufactures its cars? You know, I mean, we're being deluded. And right now, this hurricane, tornado of supposed fake news and all this talk of the deep state, which means meaningless, absolutely innocuous, meaningless term. All these terms are floating around, and people are unraveling themselves trying to figure it out. I mean, they're trying to figure out what fake news is. Well, why don't you try to figure out what's real and what's happening? You know, and study things factually. The books are there, folks. You know, you can go read them. It really, all the facts are there. It's just very frustrating to me. And, of course, like everybody, I get swept up in it. But, as confused as everybody else about what's real and what isn't real these days. But if you take a deep breath and you relax, you can figure it out. The facts are there. A fact. Donald Trump wants to destroy the Environmental Protection Agency. Okay, this is what he's going to do. He is not doing this to help the little guy. He may say he's doing it to help the little guy, but he's doing it to help corporations. You know, I mean, Obama sort of dithered around Standing Rock. It took Trump 4 days to get rid of those people. You know, this is what's going to be happening around the country. Trump is out to help the rich, political elite, and steal everything from you. That's the thing that you need to know. And that's the thing that you need to start organizing and working against, or else by the time all this fake news, deep state stuff blows over, you're going to be in prison and your environment's going to be gone.
You write that the media organizes itself the way the CIA does, that the CIA has case officers running around the world engaged in murder and mayhem, and the media has reporters covering them. What are the similarities between the organization of the media and the organization of the CIA?
Yeah, okay. And that gets it to absolutely, well, what is America? Well, you know, America started out as a slave state, but it was always a capitalist state. The people that created our country were large landowners. You know, and they didn't like paying taxes to the British, so they created a government that initially excluded women, men who didn't own property, and blacks, of course, who the Constitution rated as 3/5 of human being. And they killed all the indigenous people on the continent over the course of, you know, 300 years or whatever it was, and stole everything they had. That is the ethic. These are the ethics that define the United States of America. And that since the country was created, as it's sort of liberalized, systems have been put in place to maintain the status and prerogatives of the ruling class, the same kind of ruling class that created this country. And as it expands, laws, tax laws, property laws, all kind of, you know, a whole... starting in the beginning of the 20th century, you know, departments of justice, customs, all these different systems are put in place. And the systems are all designed to protect the interests of this rich ruling class. And while we don't have slavery anymore, it took until the 1960s to get rid of the Jim Crow laws and segregation. And of course, we're still a segregated country. You know, I mean, that still exists. And black people are still pitted against poor white people, just like they were when the country was created. And all these systems are in place, but now they're more highly bureaucratized. Technocrats run them. They're in place and they're so deep, it seems like you can't see them, although you can feel them and you can see the results of them all the time. And one of the things, one of the systems that's evolved in the 250 years that we've been around is the system of information, of how we view our country, what we know about it. And the same way that the rich ruling elite has controlled and structured all these other systems. And believe me, it wasn't the little guy that put these systems in place. It was the rich political elite that puts all these systems in place. They have put in systems of media management. Okay. And in this sense, the media serves basically the same function as the CIA, which is a system, or the military, which is a system, or the education system, which of course is part of the media. And as you know, if you went to school, you grew up being told that America was the greatest country on the earth, and you probably weren't told about slavery, and you probably weren't told about a lot of things that anything that diminished America's stature in your little adolescent mind. And you grew up believing all these myths about America as the land of opportunity and the country that's going to bring democracy to the world. And in the meantime, it's got this hidden CIA, and it's waging war, and it's got the biggest military in the world, a military that's bigger than all the other militaries of the world combined. And yet you still think it's a victim, and you got to worry about ISIS and Muslims and Mexican immigrants. Well, why is this? Because a system of media management has been put in place and has evolved over 250 years as well. And that's that system of media management, which extends into education and everything else that you learn, and Hollywood and TV especially, which is the ultimate, because as the little guy, your only function is to buy commodities that the capitalists produce at outrageous rates. And buy commodities that you don't need, have no value to your, have no intrinsic value to your life, but simply pollute the environment and make your life worse. But TV ads make you think that all this stuff is fine. And when you see people on TV, you say, God, I want to be like him. I want to be like Meryl Streep, or I want to be like Paul Newman, you know, I mean, and I could live that life, you know, and these systems, which not just TV and the movies and education system, but the daily news that you get. All these things are controlled. They're a system that are controlled the same way that the CIA is controlled. And at the very highest levels of the media, they are the CIA. And that's why they don't tell you about the CIA, because that's their part in the overall spectacle, is not to tell you about these things so you continue to believe all these myths about America, and not just myths about America, but most importantly, myths about yourself that you've learned through your education, through what you see on TV, and that the, as soon as Nike comes out with a new pair of sneakers, boom, off you go and you buy it. And maybe you're a Pepsi guy, or maybe you're a Coke guy, you know, but you like Pepsi and you like Coke because, like Trump, they say they want good relations with Russia. You know, and so you know, it's all the systems that have been in place are elaborate, and they've evolved over 200 years, but they all have the same purpose. And that's why I say in the book, at the highest levels, the CIA is the same as the media. And the way you rise from, you know, a lowly entry-level person in the CIA to head the CIA is the same way you rise up through, you know, the New York Times, for example. You know, you start out as a cub reporter, and if you write articles that show that you have an aptitude for disclosing, for covering up the things that Americans shouldn't know, and telling them the things that they should know, the way they should know it, well, then maybe you'll become a more important reporter. You know, and then if you really, they might let you actually have contact with a CIA officer, You know, and up you go until through all these ideological, tests that are given to you until, you know, someday you're in executive management and you're actually talking to guys in the CIA executive management and they're telling you, well, you know, in about 2 years, we're going to be overthrowing the government of the Philippines, you know, which we really don't like right now because they've been bad to Westinghouse. And Westinghouse wants to build a nuclear reactor in one of their provinces. And there's a bunch of congressmen there. And we're getting rid of them, by the way. But when we do, you know, there's going to be room for you guys there and you're going to get a news bureau and stuff like that. I mean, that's what goes on at these highest levels. And these people at the highest level have no blinders over their eyes. They have no illusions. They're all in it together as a mafia. And again, it's hard to explain these things in 20 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour. And even this book, The CIA's Organized Crime, how its operations corrupt everything. And that's corruption in the sense of corrupting you so that you don't know who you are. You're not even in touch with your humanity or the humanity of, you know, say if you're, you know, you might have feelings about blacks, or you might have, if you're black, you might have feelings about Mexicans. I mean, how the information you receive is through the media is making you feel these things. If you want to understand those kind of things, read my book. You know, some of these other things that you talk about, I don't know anything about, but very realistically, the book outlines how that works, how that systems work. And, it has to do with capitalism and the ideology that capitalism advances, which is, you know, that 1% of the 1% of the 1% are the big dogs and they deserve everything because they take it.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Okay, Bonnie. Oh, thanks for letting me ramble on. And I hope I haven't disappointed too many of your listeners.
I've been speaking with Douglas Valentine. Today's show has been The Deep State as Fake News. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, available at claritypress.com. Visit his website at douglasvalentine.com. That's douglasvalentine.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, as Pakistan demands that the U.S. stop bombing it from the sky, Chris Hedges speaks of what war does to the minds of those on the ground, including the soldiers. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm an old English major, so I'm deeply interested in the connections among the world and our understanding and compositions of words. I like nonfiction even more than fiction. Today we'll hear from a master of nonfiction words, Chris Hedges. Hedges is the son of a clergyman, of an unusually liberal Presbyterian minister. Chris himself got a divinity degree from Harvard, but was never ordained. Instead, he became a very respected foreign correspondent, for the most part a war correspondent. He worked for some fine newspapers, including 15 years at the New York Times. The Times fired him for speaking out against the Iraq War, not in his reporting, but off duty on his own time. Hedges has kept writing and kept speaking out on public policy. His words sound like they come from a clergyman, and they sound like they come from a veteran journalist. Today, we'll hear that prophetic voice speaking on a topic he knows all too well, war. Since I was born in 1950, the United States has been continuously at war in one third world country or another. We are awash in blood, most of it the blood of innocent people. When the government does it, none dare call it bloody murder. Hedges has covered some recent wars, all of which our country at least had a hand in. El Salvador, Yugoslavia, Gulf War I, and the Israeli attacks on Gaza. When Hedges writes about war, his focus is not on the general's strategies or the political goals of the conflict. His focus is on the ground, where the bullets are slamming into flesh, and people are crushed beneath collapsing buildings, and even the soldiers are feeling more and more traumatized. He describes the lives of people on the receiving end of war, and that includes civilians and soldiers, and also himself and his fellow journalists. In 2002, Hedges published a good slim book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Today, we'll hear a talk that discusses many of the issues from that book. It's about the attractive, addictive pull of war. War addicts people as it destroys them psychologically. War is like heroin. First, though, let's hear Hedges talk about an earlier war, World War II, the good war, the establishment loves to call it, and how this war affected some of the American soldiers who fought it and survived it. Here, Hedges is asked if his father had been radicalized in the 1930s, and Hedges replies, no.
I think my father was, like many of his generation, radicalized by World War II. We've mythologized World War II. He and most of my uncles were in the war. I had one uncle that was physically and emotionally destroyed in the South Pacific, drank himself to death in a trailer. I mean, and I think that that wasn't uncommon with combat vets who suffered from what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. There was no name for it then, and very little understanding or sympathy. So even though my uncle, for instance, mailed all of his medals back to the Pentagon, he hated war. He was destroyed by war. And our family, he was an embarrassment. I mean, there was no alcohol in the manse where I grew up, and yet my uncle was a drunk. I think there were probably tens of thousands of families who were caring for people who had been psychologically and physically maimed, but they were shunted aside. because they didn't fit that kind of mythic narrative. And I really grew up because of that in the shadow of World War II. The shadow of the war fell upon my family.
So much for the good war. Now, onto the wars that we remember. Here is Chris Hedges speaking of how war is a force that gives us meaning.
We can, from the safety of the United States, thrill in the perversity of war, even as we watch films or read books that are meant to denounce war. It is almost impossible to produce anti-war films or books or documentaries that also present images of battle. It is like trying to condemn pornography while showing erotic love scenes. The prurient fascination with violent death always overpowers the message. There is a film by the French filmmaker René Clément called Le Jeu Interdit, or Forbidden Games. It is about two children who play war games in France in World War II. During the entire film, they bury things. They are obsessed with death, but there is only one scene when they are fleeing with a column of French refugees and are attacked by German planes, when we see images of battle. In that scene, the little girl's parents are killed. She is told her parents have been buried. She imagines her mother and father under the earth. The boy and the orphan girl are shown in the village, and all they do is bury dolls, dead bugs, animals, until they have to create corpses to bury. Their lives, their focus, their actions are concerned only with death. This, for me, is an insight into the brutalizing effect of war, what it does to culture, to children, and to civilization. Death is inherent to war. Yet we are sadly unaware of how war distorts us, how it brings out within us the morbid, the brutal, the macabre. We embrace instead the abstract words of glory, honor, courage, patriotism that mask the reality of war. Abstract words that in combat are not only rendered hollow, but obscene. War is part of the modern industrial landscape. Indeed, its tools are often the cutting edge of technology. By World War I, we had created ways in which thousands of people who never saw their attackers could die in an instant. And weapons that carry out this impersonal mass slaughter are beautiful. They are crafted, sleek, and harbor within them awesome power. The machines of war, the planes, the tanks, the heavy machine guns, the huge hulking howitzers and the helicopters are pieces of art. I have seen them at work. They are angels of death streaking through the sky. I was with a unit of guerrillas in El Salvador when some Huey helicopters raced in over a lake to hunt us down. We hid in the ruins of an abandoned village, darting from wall to wall and standing with our backs to the shattered bricks so our hunters could not see us as they passed low overhead. Yet even as I looked up at these machines that were trying to kill me, I found them seductive. Once in a conflict, once we live in the midst of the fighting, we are moved from the abstract to the real, from the mythic to the sensory. No soldier after a few seconds of combat believes in the myth of war anymore. And this is why wounded Marines jeered John Wayne when he visited them in a hospital in World War II. When this move takes place, we have nothing to do with a world not at war. The world, when we return to it, is viewed always from the end of a very long tunnel. There they still believe. There they do not understand. We feel different, wiser, greater. And this experience is so overpowering that if we can control our fear, we go back to seek it out again. War is addictive. Indeed, it is the most potent narcotic invented by humankind. The first time I was in an ambush was in the Salvadoran town of Suchitoto. It was a dreary peasant outpost made up of stucco and mud and wattle huts off the main road. The town was surrounded by the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front rebels, who, when I arrived in El Salvador, were winning the war. The government forces kept a small garrison in the town, although its relief columns were frequently ambushed as they ambled down the small strip of asphalt surrounded by high grass. It was one of the most dangerous spots in the country. The rebels launched an attack to take the town. A convoy of reporters and cars marked with TV and masking tape on the windshields hightailed it to the small bridge that led to the lonely stretch of road into Suchitoto. We stopped for the familiar ritual of getting high, something as a print reporter who could scramble to safety I did not do, but something the photographers who would stand and take pictures found a necessary balm to their nerves. Then we moved slowly down the road, the odd round fired ahead or behind us. We made it to the edge of town, where we ran into rebel units, now accustomed to the follies of the press. On foot, we moved through the deserted streets. The firing from the garrison became louder as we weaved our way with rebel units to the siege that had been set up. Then, as I rounded a corner, several full bursts of automatic fire rent the air. Bullets hit the mud wall behind me. We dove into the dirt. The rebels began to fire noisy rounds from their M16 assault rifles. The scent of cordite filled the air. Rebels around me were wounded, crying out in pain. One died, yelling in a sad cadence for his mother, his desperate and final plea slicing through the absurd posturing of soldiering. At first, his cries haunted me. Soon, I just wished he would be quiet. The firefight seemed to go on for eternity. I cannot say how long I lay there. It could have been a few minutes. It could have been an hour. Here was war, real war, sensory war, not the mythic war of movies and novels I had consumed in my youth. It was horrifying, confusing, numbing, and nothing like the myth I had been peddled. I realized at once that it controlled me. I would never control it. In a lull, I made a dash across an empty square to find shelter behind a house. My heart was racing. Adrenaline coursed through my bloodstream, but I was safe. I made it back to the capital and, like most war correspondents, soon considered the experience a great cosmic joke. I drank away the fear in a seedy bar in downtown San Salvador that night. Most people, after such an experience, would learn to stay away. I was hooked. Drawn into the world of war, it becomes hard to escape. It perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physical. I covered the war in El Salvador from 1983 to 1988. By the end, I had a nervous twitch in my face. I was evacuated 3 times by the U.S. Embassy because of tips that the death squads planned to kill me. Yet each time, I came back. I accepted with a grim fatalism that I would be killed in El Salvador. I could not articulate why I accepted my own destruction and cannot now. There came to be a part of me, maybe it is a part in all of us, which decided I would rather die like this than go back to the dull routine. During the war in El Salvador, I worked with a photographer who covered the war, had a slew of close calls, and then called it quits. He moved to Miami and took pictures of tepid domestic stories for one of the news weeklies. But life in Florida was flat, dull, uninteresting. He could not adjust and soon came back. From the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. And just as there are some soldiers or war correspondents that seem to us immortal, and whose loss comes as a sobering reminder that death has no favorites, there are also those in war who are locked in a grim embrace with death from which they cannot escape. He was frightening to behold, a walking corpse. He was shot through the back in a firefight and died in less than a minute. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the Eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the thanatos, or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was therefore pessimistic about ever eradicating war. All human history, he argued, in civilization and its discontents, is a tug of war between these two instincts. Taste enough of war, and you come to believe the Stoics were right. We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rear guard, and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. And this is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. The job of killing allows our senses to command our bodies. The killing whips fighters into greater orgies of destruction. Hedonism and perversion spirals out of control. Those who worked hard all their lives are reviled as dupes and fools. They haunt the soup kitchens. The loyalty they express to the state or to the institutions they worked for has left them beggars. They collect pensions when they are paid that amount to a few dollars. The normal order is turned upside down. Decency, sobriety, and honesty, moderation no longer pay. Better to give yourself up to the lust of war. In war, we deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity, to make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, and to defend love can become self-destructive. But in the rise to power, we always become smaller. Power absorbs us, and once power is obtained, we are its pawn. As in Shakespeare's Richard III, the all-powerful prince who molded the world, we fall prey to the forces we thought we had harnessed. Love may not always triumph, but it keeps us human. It offers the only chance to escape from the contagion of war. Perhaps it is the only antidote, and there are times when remaining human is the only victory possible. When the mask of war slips away and the rot and corruption is uncovered, when it turns sour and rank, when the myth is exposed as a fraud, we feel soiled and spent. It is then that we sink into despair. In the Arab-Israeli 1973 war, almost a third of all Israeli casualties were due to psychiatric causes, and the war lasted only a few days. A World War II study determined that after 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of all surviving soldiers will have become psychiatric casualties, and a common trait among the 2% who were able to endure sustained combat was a predisposition towards aggressive, psychopathic personalities. During the war in El Salvador, soldiers could serve in the army for 3 or 4 years or longer, virtually until they psychologically or physically collapsed. In garrison towns, commanders banned the sale of sedatives because of the abuse by troops. In this war, the emotionally maimed were common. I interviewed a 19-year-old Salvadoran army sergeant who had spent 5 years fighting and suddenly lost his vision after his unit walked into a rebel ambush. The rebels killed 11 soldiers in the firefight, including his closest friend. A couple dozen soldiers were wounded. He was unable to see again until he was placed in the army hospital. "I have these horrible headaches," he told me, sitting on the edge of his bed. "There is shrapnel in my head. I keep telling the doctors to take it out." But the doctors told me he had no head wounds. I have seen soldiers in other conflicts go deaf or stop speaking or simply shake without being able to stop. War is necrophilia, and this necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. It is hidden under platitudes about duty and comradeship, but it waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. When we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. In Milovangelis' memoir of the partisan war in Yugoslavia, he wrote of the enticement death held for the combatants. He stood over the body of his comrade, the commander Sava Kovekovich, and found, "Dying did not seem terrible or unjust. This was the most extraordinary, the most exalted moment of my life. Death did not seem strange or undesirable. That I restrained myself from charging blindly into the fray and death was perhaps due to my sense of obligation to the troops or to some comrade's reminder concerning the tasks at hand. In my memory, I returned to those moments many times with the same feeling of intimacy with death and desire for it while I was in prison, especially during my first incarceration." When we see this, when we see our addiction for what it is, when we understand ourselves and how war has perverted us, life becomes hard to bear. John Steele, a cameraman who spent years in war zones, had a nervous breakdown in a crowded Heathrow airport in 1994 after returning from Sarajevo. He understood the reality of his work, a reality that stripped away the self-righteous, high-octane gloss. "I came back from Sarajevo," he said in an interview. "We were in a place called Sniper's Alley. I filmed a girl there who had been hit in the neck by a sniper's bullet. I filmed her in the ambulance, and only after she was dead, I suddenly understood that the last thing she had seen was the reflection of the lens of the camera I was holding in front of her face. This wiped me out. I grabbed the camera and I started running down Sniper's Alley, filming at knee level the Bosnians running from place to place." A year after the war in Sarajevo, I sat with Bosnian friends who had suffered horribly. A young woman, Liliana, had lost her father, a Serb, who refused to join the besieging Serb forces around the city. She had been forced a few days earlier to identify his corpse. The body was lifted, the water running out of the sides of a rotting coffin from a small park for reburial in the central cemetery. She was emigrating for Australia soon, where she told me, "I will marry a man who has never heard of this war and raise children that will be told nothing about it, nothing about the country I am from." Liliana was young, but the war had exacted a toll. Her cheeks were hollow, her hair dry and brittle. Her teeth were decayed and some had broken into jagged bits. She had no money for a dentist. She hoped to fix them in Australia. Yet, all she and her friends did that afternoon was lament the days when they lived in fear and hunger, emaciated, targeted by Serb gunners on the heights above. They did not wish back the suffering, and yet they admitted these may have been the fullest days of their lives. They looked at me in despair. I knew them when they were being pounded by hundreds of shells a day, when they had no water to bathe in or wash their clothes, when they huddled in unheated apartments as sniper bullets hit the walls outside. But what they expressed was real. It was the disillusionment with a sterile, futile, and empty present. Peace had again peeled back the void the rush of war, of battle, had filled. Once again they were, as perhaps we all are, alone, no longer bound by that common sense of struggle, no longer given the opportunity to be noble, heroic, no longer sure what life was about or what it meant. The old comradeship, however false, that allowed them to love men and women they hardly knew, indeed whom they may not have liked before the war, had vanished with the last shot. Moreover, they had seen that all the sacrifice had been for naught. They had been, as we all are in war, betrayed. The corrupt old Communist Party bosses, who became nationalists overnight and got them into the mess in the first place, had grown rich off their suffering and were still in power. There was a 70% unemployment rate. They depended on handouts from the international community. They knew the lie of war, the mockery of their idealism, and struggled with their shattered illusions. They understood that their cause, once as fashionable in certain intellectual circles as they were themselves, lay forgotten. No longer did actors, politicians, and artists scramble to come and visit during the ceasefires, acts that were almost always ones of gross self-promotion. And yet, they wished it all back, and I did too. A year later, I received a Christmas card. It was signed Liliana from Australia. It had no return address. I never heard from her again. But many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past 20 years did not escape. They could not break free from the dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit. By then, I was back in Gaza and found myself pinned down in another ambush. A young Palestinian 15 feet away from me was shot through the chest and killed. I had been lured back, but now felt none of the old rush, just fear. It was time to break free, to let go, to accept that none of this would or could or should come back. I knew then that it was over. I was lucky to get out alive. Kurt Schork, brilliant, courageous, and driven, could not let go. He died in an ambush in May of 2000 in Sierra Leone, along with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno. His entrapment, his embrace of thanatos, of the death instinct, was never questioned at the sterile and antiseptic memorial service staged for him in Washington. Everyone tiptoed around it, but for those of us who knew him, we understood that he had been consumed.
Chris Hedges. And for the audio, I thank my friend and fellow radio guy, Robin Upton. From sunny Bangladesh, of all places, Robin produces the weekly two-hour radio show, Unwelcome Guests. You can check that out at unwelcomeguests.net. And you can catch up on our own shows at our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, and I thank you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimae non carborundum. Please come back again next week, and please remember, war is not healthy for children and other living things. Ciao. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. There's a lot happening in the 9/11 truth world around this 16th anniversary of 9/11. Although you'd never know it by listening to the controlled corporate media. There are so many courageous, intelligent, and persistent people in the U.S. and around the world working for 9/11 Truth. Today you're going to hear from three of them, speaking at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on 9/11/2017. This is the kickoff ceremony for the new Bobby McElvain Act, which would hopefully get us a new investigation into the events of 9/11. So first we're going to hear from these three courageous, patriotic Americans, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the Bobby McElvain Act. And these three today are Architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, victim's family member, and tireless seeker of 9/11 Truth, Bob McElvain, and new to the 9/11 Truth movement, whistleblower and former NIST employee, Peter Michael Ketchum. So here they are at the kickoff of the Bobby McElvain World Trade Center Investigation Act at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2017.
Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Gage, AIA, 30-year architect and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We now represent nearly 3,000 architects and engineers, collectively more than 30,000 years of building and technical experience, who have signed our petition calling for a new investigation of the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. I'm joined today by Bob McElvain, father of 9/11 victim Bobby McElvain, and Peter Michael Ketchum, former employee of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. We're here today to announce the launch of the Bobby McElvain Act, the Bobby McElvain World Trade Center Investigation Act, The Bobby McIlvaine Act is named after Bob's son, Bobby, who was tragically killed at the age of 26 while entering the North Tower at the World Trade Center. The act is draft legislation that would impanel a select committee from either chamber of Congress to investigate the destruction of the three World Trade Center towers 16 years ago today. Indeed, it has been more than a decade and a half, and the American people have still not been given an unbiased scientific investigation into the destruction that took nearly 3,000 lives on 9/11. In 2002, the U.S. Congress passed legislation that mandated that NIST investigate and explain the three worst structural failures in modern history. Unfortunately, NIST did not conduct the unbiased and scientific investigation that the American people deserved. According to NIST's own plan, the investigation started with the predetermined conclusion that all three high-rise collapses were due to fire. As a result, NIST ignored and even denied the existence of irrefutable evidence that didn't fit its preconceived notion of how the buildings collapsed. This, ladies and gentlemen, is not how science is conducted. And so, the nearly 3,000 architects and engineers have put their names and their careers on the line to speak out. They're calling upon Congress to open a new investigation, which takes into account all the evidence. They're backed by more than two dozen 9/11 family members who have also signed our petition, and many more who are calling for the truth about the death of their loved ones. Bob McIlvaine has been at the forefront of this fight for justice. He's a tireless advocate for a new investigation. Since the release of the 9/11 Commission report in 2004, today he's the driving force behind the Bobby McIlvaine Act. Bob, I'm honored to share this moment with you.
I don't have a long speech or anything, but as you say, I've been doing this. I started all this after Bobby died. I got into the peace movement, and it really was for me, was extremely cathartic. You know, I went around the world. I did a stone walk in Japan. I went to Bogota, Colombia, on a conference on violence. People from all around the world were there. But I would talk war and peace, and I felt so great about it. I really did. I would talk in high schools. I would talk in college, and people would say, well, your son was murdered. I said, well, it's no reason to go to war. And I really enjoyed that. It was cathartic. My wife enjoyed it. She did it with me. Then after the 9/11 Commission, it was after Condoleezza Rice spoke. I made 95% of the commission meetings. And after Condoleezza Rice was there, I'll just never forget it. I can't remember anyone that was there, but I remember Condoleezza Rice, and she was talking about in August, about Bin Laden supposedly attacking the United States, so forth and so on. And she used the filibuster rule so well. She would just start blabbing about anything. But you must understand, and, one of the commissioner, Benveniste, would say, please answer the question, but you must understand what transpired before this. And each commissioner only had 5 minutes. And then he had to sit down. The next commissioner would get up. Well, I had an interview with, I forget who afterwards, I think it was Canadian Broadcasting. And I was so ticked off. I actually started cursing. I was so angry. I just can't believe this. It was an absolute joke. And then from that, I've done nothing but 9/11, truth, because all the peace marches I made, traveling around the world, it did nothing, absolutely nothing. So I get the opportunity to speak to people around the world. I'm constantly talking to people, and I stick to the story. And the story, of course, is about Bobby. Nobody gets upset. It never gets old. I practice this, but then I have to get up, emotional. And, I understand why, but, I walk into here and I think, oh, I'm fine, nothing. But this is what I wrote up for today. Okay, our son Bobby, and my eyes are getting bad. And if I'm shaking, I always shake, so it's not just because of today. Our son Bobby, age 28, perished on 9/11. We lost a dear son, and the world lost an incredible man who loved life and lived it to the fullest. He was an intense young man who, from the time he was a tiny preschooler to the day of his death, put 110% effort into every task. An outstanding scholar and athlete in high school, he chose to attend Princeton University, where he majored in literature and minored in African American studies. His senior thesis, Shadows in the Snow, won an award from the Center for African American Studies at Princeton. After graduation, the love of books sent him to the direction of publishing houses in New York. In the first year as a publicist with Henry Holt and Company, he managed to launch one of his authors to the top of the New York bestseller list. In July 2001, he decided to try his hand in the business world and was delighted to join Merrill Lynch approximately 2 weeks before 9/11 as an assistant vice president of media relations. He was also in the process of applying to Harvard and Penn graduate programs in business. He was truly on his way. But he would have turned into a writer because that was his true love. You know, I'm sure he might have gone into business because to live in New York, he had to make money. And he couldn't buy writing books without getting them published. So, but he was, you know, wrote religiously. After the collapse of the towers, my wife's son and I came up to New York in search of Bobby. On September 13th, we received notice from the morgue that Bobby had been one of the first located outside the towers. We felt fortunate that we were able to claim the body and bring him home to a proper burial in Pennsylvania. And that at that time, there, you know, we came up on a Tuesday or Wednesday. There was just no bodies in New York, none whatsoever. And the fact that we found them that week was just mind-boggling. It was then that I began to try to reconstruct the circumstances of my son's death. In the weeks, months, and years that followed, I spoke with Bobby's Merrill Lynch colleagues and supervisors, New York City police and firemen, EMT workers, and, of course, the New York City coroner. From what I learned, Bobby had died instantly while approaching the lobby of the tower, or Tower 1, not just Tower 1. His body was taken to the morgue prior to the collapse of the building. To continue my quest, I attended the 9/11 commission hearings, patiently listening to testimony while hoping to find answers, but instead heard an official story that made little sense based on what I knew about Bobby's death. I felt frustrated, and the inability of the commission to discover anything new or enlightening to help me understand what happened that day. What really made sense to me was the body of evidence presented by architects and engineers for 9/11 truth. Their scientific explanation of the destruction of the three buildings was in line with my research. A&E had no hidden agenda. They were scientists and structural engineers who cannot be persuaded by political gibberish. Instead of conjecture, they offer irrefutable concrete proof that the towers were brought down by controlled demolition. We need, as a family and as a nation, to learn the truth about 9/11, a truth that makes sense and stands up to the test of science and logic. Please, I urge you, speaking to anyone that wants to listen, specifically the press, to consider a new, more thorough investigation into the destruction of the towers and the loss of so many young men and women like Bobby McElvain. Okay, thank you.
Bob, I'm inspired by your devotion to your son and the other 9/11 victims and family members, and particularly your dedication, which is unyielding to the truth. I mean, it just inspires all of us. Thank you. Next, I'd like to introduce Peter Michael Ketchum, who worked at NIST from 1997 to 2011. In 2016, he read the NIST reports for the first time and immediately realized that they did not meet the high scientific standard that he had come to know during his 14-year tenure at NIST, rather than staying quiet like the rest of them, he decided to follow his conscience and speak out. Peter, we're grateful to have you with us today.
So, good afternoon, and as Richard mentioned, my name is Peter Michael Ketchum. I was a member of the research staff at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, otherwise known as NIST, during the years 1997 to 2011. I initially joined the High Performance Systems and Services Division and later became a member of what was, at the time, the Mathematical and Computational Sciences Division of the Information Technology Laboratory. I believe that NIST is one of the crown jewels of the U.S. federal government and an organization of staggering brilliance. But with respect to the World Trade Center investigation, I think that something went very wrong. I was not involved in the NIST World Trade Center investigation. But in August 2016, I began to seriously examine the reports of that investigation, specifically NIST NC-STAR 1 and NC-STAR 1A. The more I examined, the more apparent it became that NIST had reached a predetermined conclusion that refused, avoided, and dismissed the evidence. Among the most egregious examples is the explanation for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 as a sequence of unlikely events, culminating in the almost symmetrical collapse of a steel frame building into its own footprint at freefall acceleration. National security concerns and public safety concerns do not stand in isolation, but rather participate in a balance with accountability. The NIST I knew was intellectually open, willing to consider competing explanations, and enthusiastic about presenting the details of its research to any interested party. If NIST truly believes in the veracity of its World Trade Center investigation, then it should openly share all evidence, data, models, computations, and other relevant information unless specific and compelling reasons are otherwise provided. Passage of the Bobby McIlvain World Trade Center Investigation Act opens the door to a new investigation that is complete, thorough, detailed, exhaustive, independent, and unbiased. Why is a new World Trade Center investigation important? It is important because the wounds of 9/11 have remained unhealed for too long, and they are now rotting, festering, and infected. But those wounds are unlikely to heal amid lies, deception, and misinformation. That is why the truth is so important. Truth is the hot, soapy water with which we wash out the wounds of 9/11 so that true healing can begin. Truth is where our healing lies. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you getting it? Thank you, Peter. If it wasn't already obvious enough that NIST did not conduct the investigation that was mandated by Congress, we at AE 9/11 Truth have now funded a two-year, $300,000 finite element analysis computer modeling study of the collapse of World Trade Center 7. by researchers at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks in order to determine conclusively whether office fires could have brought the building down or not. Last week, the World Trade Center 7 study lead investigator, Professor Leroy Halsey, a practicing forensic and structural engineer of more than 50 years, announced in the progress report the study's main finding. What was that? Office fires did not bring down the World Trade Center Building 7. When the final report is published a few months from now, we'll take it to every member of Congress and urge them to enact the Bobby McIlvain Act. Given the failure of NIST to conduct the scientific investigation mandated by Congress, the burden is now upon Congress to launch a new investigation. At the conclusion of today's press conference here in Washington, D.C., we will hand-deliver the Bobby McIlvain package to every member of Congress. Bob and I will be meeting with his congressman, and we also have appointments with several other congressional offices. I urge our supporters to visit our website, ae911truth.org, and use the information there to contact your own members of Congress. Reporters, we're available to answer questions and explain the evidence as needed in the coming days. We have an excellent set of publications and videos available for you as well. Now we'll take a few moments to answer any questions you may have at this time, and after our Q&A, if time allows, we'll review the explosive evidence.
And again, you were just listening to the kickoff of the Bobby McIlvain World Trade Center Investigation Act, designed to get us a new investigation into what happened at the World Trade Center on 9/11. I have a copy of the Bobby McIlvain Act in front of me, and what it does is it establishes a select committee, a congressional select committee, to investigate the destruction of the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. It also says that the speaker shall appoint 12 members to the select committee, five of whom shall be appointed after consultation with the minority leader. And then the speaker shall designate one member to serve as chair of the select committee. And the select committee is authorized and directed to conduct a full and complete investigation and study and issue a final report of its findings to the House regarding the likely technical cause or causes of the destruction of the World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7, including a full inquiry into the possible use of explosives and or incendiaries that may have been the actual cause of the destruction, and the circumstances surrounding the destruction of World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7 that would have allowed for their destruction by means of controlled demolition using explosives and or incendiaries, and the validity or lack thereof of the findings and conclusions of the investigation conducted by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which, if you've been paying attention, you know their report was totally bogus. Then they spell out the procedures that have to be used by this committee, and this is where, you know, I was thinking, great, another investigation by our corrupt Congress. But this bill, with these procedures in place, it sounds like it would keep it honest, or at least, you know, somewhat honest. And here is what they request. That the chair of the select committee may authorize and issue subpoenas. And that's where the other two investigations didn't. The 9/11 Commission report never subpoenaed anybody, so people refused to come forward if they weren't required to because they were afraid of retribution, losing their jobs, etc. And also, they may order the taking of depositions under oath. So Bush and Cheney testified to the 9/11 Commission not under oath and not recorded, and the public never got to hear what they had to say about 9/11. This act also stipulates that members of the select committee are allowed to question a witness for periods longer than 5 minutes. And that was one of the downfalls of the 9/11 Commission. They only allowed each commissioner 5 minutes. And as you heard Bob McIlvain say, people like Condoleezza Rice just talked and talked until the time was up and said nothing. And then the last part of it is really interesting. It says the select committee shall take testimony from no fewer than three experts in engineering or related fields who present evidence supporting the theory that explosives and or incendiaries were used in the destruction of the World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7. So this part ensures that they can't avoid the question of controlled demolition and all the mountains of evidence supporting that. that the Congressional Joint Inquiry did or that the 9/11 Commission report did. Both of them just ignored the topic of controlled demolition. So where you come in this, and the part that you can play, is you can call your congressperson and ask them to sponsor or support the Bobby McIlvaine World Trade Center Investigation Act. And I'm going to spell McIlvaine for you. It's M-C-I-L-V-A-I-N-E. So M-C-I-L-V-A-I-N-E. So the Bobby McIlvaine World Trade Center Investigation Act. So please do so and call your congressperson and ask them to sponsor or support this act. And do your part for 9/11 truth. The whole world is depending on it. And if not you, then who? And I'm going to end the show today with a song by two local musicians, Carl Seeger Henry and Gary J. Fox Jr. And their song is Building 7. And I think they capture the sentiments of all in the 9/11 truth movement when they sing, "We won't move on." I think we all feel that we won't move on until we have the truth and the fraudulent official account of 9/11 is exposed to all for what it really is. And until the propaganda-filled 9/11 Museum in New York City is forced to close or to finally showcase the truth.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
We march and rally to support the Spectrum Strikers.
On strike, 6 months and counting, Spectrum cable workers head from the picket line to cross bridges to build support amongst the public for their fight for a fair contract and to save their union amidst a media whiteout of their historic labor struggle.
We're at Cadman Plaza, and we see a good friend. We've been seeing him for 6 months now. Brother, there are too few people in this city who understand what it's like to have been out of work, to be on a picket line for 6 months. Tell us who you are, the kind of work you do, and what it's meant to be on strike for 6 months.
Troy Walcott, steward for Spectrum Cable. 6 months out of work. I don't really think you could explain in words without actually being through it. And some of our people right now are not knowing how they're surviving. But when you look at the alternative, not being able to provide for their families for the future, there's really no choice they have but to fight to try to keep only what we already have.
You've been out for 6 months. How are you doing? How's your family doing?
It's been trying for me with not only the burden of my family, but the burden of all the members' families on my back. My stuff is bad until sometimes you hear someone else's stories. Being on the border, being put out of their homes, not understanding of how they're going to be able to take care of a sick child. The burden turns from my simple problems to the problems of many, and it starts to see a much larger picture than just myself.
Tell us the issues that have made you folks stay out, stay strong for 6 months now.
What the company did was tell us that our benefits as far as medical, pension, moving forward, and the dignity that we have as workers wasn't as important. They would transfer and give us compensation, extra cash to make up and taken away from the benefits and the pensions that support our future. They told us, and they've been telling the news media for months now, that they've offered us a robust compensation package. Who would take 6 months out of work with no pay because someone's offering them more money? It's a shell game that they're playing. Our workers saw right through it, and they know our future is important more than a dollar today.
There are 500 scabs out there doing your work. Many of them come from out of state. There was a provision in the leasing agreement that they could not bring in out-of-state workers. What's going on with them? Are they trying to break the union? Are you going to stand for it?
Definitely trying to break the union. The company is using them as pawns. They bring them out of state to do the work undertrained. They don't care about customer quality. As long as they can put a face or a body in front of someone to fill the spot, that's what they're doing. And these people are coming into New York City, taking wages and work from here and taking it back to their state and leaving the New York City economy undercut. They're using them as pawns to attack the way of life that we have here in New York City as far as being able to keep decent wages and decent benefits.
Tell us about the kind of work that you and your brothers here do.
We provide service for New York City. Cable, internet, phone. We're a lifeline for communication for the city, and people depend on it. What the company is doing is using that dependency and the franchise agreement they hold to hold people hostage. When customers complain or workers complain about rights being violated, because they have a franchise agreement, a hold on the city where people don't have much of a choice, they're using it as tyranny to make sure that they be able to control how our lives lives and how the customers are maintain their service. Me personally, if there's a section in the city that doesn't have cable service, I find a way to bring it to that area. And the men and women that work with me, every aspect from the cable that has to deal with, from laying it to providing the service that keeps it running in people's homes, everything that has to do with that service, we take care of.
And there's been some innuendo that Spectrum is ripping off the consumer.
It's something that we've been saying for a long time. We've had numerous of our technicians that have been actually disciplined for work that we were telling the company for years now that was beyond our control, that we couldn't fix, and we didn't have the statistics to prove it. And now with the Attorney General lawsuit, it just came to light that we were correct. The service that we were trying to go out and fix on a daily basis and getting blamed for were things that Spectrum Cable was lying to the customers about, not only lying to them, lying to us and we took the blame.
The situation's been going on for 6 months. Scabs coming in, people talking about that they are trying to bust the union. Is today a game changer? All the support you're getting from unions throughout the city, from politicians, from community groups, is this the beginning of a real fight back?
This is going to be the beginning of not just a fight. Spectrum tried to start a fight, but now this is going to turn into a movement. They've been able to beat on this for these past few months without any media attention, so they've been able to keep it quiet. Now the unions of this city are united, so they won't be able to hold our voices down any longer. So now their fight just turned into a movement.
Troy Local Union 3, IBEW, you've been holding strong. We support you. Good luck and stay strong.
Thank you, and thank you for all your support. You've been with us there since the beginning.
Stay strong.
Say, now, wait a minute. What a nurse is doing at a demonstration for IBEW, Local 3, Spectrum workers. So tell us why you're here and how important it is.
It's important to be here because as a union member, it is good to be in solidarity with others because it affects us all. Once it's recognized that they can do this to other union workers, it would soon fall back on others. So we are here to support in solidarity for our Local 3 members. I'm Jackie Gilbert.
And what kind of work do you do?
I'm a registered nurse, and I work at Harlem Hospital.
Now, we are surrounded by this whole group here. So who do we...
Hi, I'm Pat Kane. I'm the treasurer of the New York State Nurses Association. I just want to say to Local 3 that your fight is our fight. Part of your fight is maintaining your health benefits. The nurses of the New York State Nurses Association take care of all of New York. We will continue to do that. We have your back.
You're here. I mean, all these magnificent women around me are all saying, stand with Local 3. Why do you want to stand with Local 3?
If it affects one union, it affects all union.
What kind of work do you do?
I'm a registered nurse at LIJ Valley Stream.
Well, we're all brothers and sisters in the labor movement, and like we say, an attack against one is an attack against all. What they do to them, they can do to us, they can do to everybody. And we're here to say that not one union, but all unions and all workers deserve a pension, deserve retirement dignity, deserve health benefits, deserve a decent wage. And that's why we're here. We have to stick together. This is an incredible evidence of solidarity among all of us. There's 1,800 workers on strike. There's three times that many out here supporting them. It's a beautiful thing to see, and we're going to fight to the end.
Nurses love Local 3! Nurses love Local 3! Nurses love Local 3! Nurses love Local 3!
I want to thank you for the turnout to support our 1,800 Local 3 members who have been on strike against Charter Spectrum for almost 6 months. It is our hope that this march and rally will wake up this corporation to retain our pension and health benefits, dignity and security in retirement, retiree medical coverage is what's at stake. To demand that Charter settle this strike. This is blatant union busting by a CEO that made $98 million last year. At this time, I want to call up to the podium the governor of the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo.
We are going to demand the respect that we deserve. Corporate America is trying to break unions all over this country. They want to see the Supreme Court end the public employee unions as we know it. That's why they want to defund the Department of Labor. It's not going to happen. Now to the Charter Corporation. They made certain representations when they came into this state that if we allowed them in this state, they would improve the quality of service to customers. The they would invest in technology. They would build out the broadband system. Last week, we fined them $13 million for being late on their build out. And I want to know how they're going to improve customer service without the workforce that knows how to provide customer service. I am going to hold them to every letter and the spirit of that document. And if they don't get their act together and fulfill that agreement, they're going to be out of the state of New York. And I want Charter to understand, today is the beginning. The labor movement is coming together in a way they haven't come together in decades. And if we stand together as one to the proposition that union brothers and union sisters stand together in solidarity, there is no beating us. And that's what the Local 3 fight is all about. And this is a fight that we will not lose.
It's time. We're going out of this park, over that bridge, when we get on to the other side. This rally continues. You ready to march?
We're at Foley Square now. We marched over the Brooklyn Bridge with two 16-foot rats in the lead, symbolizing corporate greed, putting our brothers and sisters from Local 3 IBEW back to work. Why you got this, what is it, a 12 or a 16-foot rat?
The rat is a manifestation of our anger at this situation. It is appalling what they're doing to these workers. We're here in support of the electricians. We're part of the building trades. We're the laborers, Local 79. We're here in support of our union brothers. It's about people being exploited and our anger at that.
It's also great fun to see these rats as symbolic of bosses' greed and corporate profiteering. What do you do with the rat? How do you get it to come out to Foley Square?
Just put it on the back of the truck. It inflates. There's a little motor in there, a blower, blows up, and it goes up and down. It's just like it's a big balloon.
So it's become symbolic of anti-labor activity in this city?
And nationwide, what's going on across this nation. Here, typically, non-union workers here in New York City get paid what we got paid in the 1980s, minus the benefit. When a person gets $15, $20 an hour, how do they support themselves? They can't, can they? Why should Spectrum be allowed for the billions of dollars that they're worth, and now they're saying they don't want these Local 3 electricians? It's appalling.
These brothers have been out for 6 months now. How are they going to prevail?
If you believe in the middle class and you believe in working folks, call them. Flood their phone lines. Say stop this abuse. If you don't give people a living wage and people get pushed, then you'll see some sad times in this country. You can't feed your children or you can't pay your rent. People will do what they got to do. Have we come to that as a nation? Have we really become that?
Mind telling us who you are?
My name is Dennis Lee. I'm with Labor's Local 79.
This is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town.
For the working people of this country, the stakes have never been higher. We have had enough. We are labor, we are America's working people, and we are one. I want to acknowledge the striking Spectrum workers. I want to acknowledge the
trade union movement that are here, the community organizations that are here, to stand up, to say enough, enough. And it is my pleasure now to introduce the president of the AFL-CIO, Brother Richard Trunka. Let's hear it for a great, great trade union leader, Chris Erickson. The AFL-CIO and the anti-labor movement has your back today, tomorrow, and for as long as it takes to win a contract there. You want good wages, you want decent retirement, and you want quality, decent health care. That's not too much to ask for. So where the hell is the company? See, I have a message for Tom Rutledge. Get to the table today and negotiate a contract and put the best workers you'll ever see back on the job. Tom took home almost $100 million last year. That's more than 2,500 times what the average worker makes. And then ask us to pay more for our health care and our retirement, and then try to strip our job security and overtime pay away, and then say, I got mine, but I want a piece of yours. We got words for him. We're going to get a fair deal here. We will continue to exercise our right to strike until the company gives us a fair piece of the pie. We will not retreat in the face of corporate greed. I'm proud of my brothers and sisters at Local 3 for going on strike. It takes guts, and it's a tremendous sacrifice. And I'm encouraged by all the unions and other groups that are out here today, public and private, big and small. Standing together, fighting together, winning together. This is what solidarity is all about. And we're going to stand together, arm in arm, for as long as it takes to win a contract here. We're the labor movement, and no one pushes us around. An injury to one is an injury to all. They won't injure Local 3 without taking all of us on. God bless you. We can't win this fight alone. We need help from City Hall. We need help from the governor's office. We need help from the elected officials. They need to call out this corporation for what it is. Our New York City public advocate, Tish James.
Bring this corporation to the table and settle this
We have found two of the sisters. They've been on strike for 6 months. I can only imagine what it's like. Tell us about the work that you both do and what it's been like to be on strike for 6 months.
My name is Sandrina Bennett. I'm a level 5 technician. I'm from Northern Manhattan, and we've been on strike without a contract. No benefits, no nothing, no money.
My name is Shanta Jackson. I'm from Northern. I've worked for Spectrum Time Warner 14 years. It's been really, really difficult. My husband is the sole provider in my household at the moment. We're always robbing Peter to pay Paul, but we have to stand up for what we believe in and strongly believe we need a union, we need a fair contract, and hopefully we'll get that soon so we can get back to work and we can continue to provide for our families and for ourselves.
Well, what kind of work do you do? And then tell us what a fair contract would look like.
Level 5 is a journeyman. Of course, I'm a journeywoman. As a technician, I do installations and repairs. I've been in that field for 14 years with Spectrum, willing and open to providing the customers with great customer service and making them happy. It's really important to see them with a smile on their face when you leave.
We really need a contract because I have a daughter, a sick child. She has sickle cell. So she's in and out of hospital. So without those benefits, I don't know how I would be able to take care of my child. I'm having problems now taking care of my child. I'm a single parent. My bills is backed up. Hopefully they can come to the table and get things going.
By a fair contract, we're meaning to just keep everything that we have in place, everything that we have, it works very well for us. They want give back. They don't want to contribute into the JIB. The JIB is our fund, our pension, our annuity. That's how they compensate us for, well, compensate us with our benefits, our medical, dental, health coverage,
right,
and our future. Because without contributing their contributions into the JIB, it will hinder us when we retire.
It's been 6 months now when they brought in scabs. Are they able to provide any kind of level of service with that? And second of all, you think they're trying to break the union?
They're determined to break the union. Yes, they have brought in scabs. I would assume it will take two of them to accomplish what one of us can do. It's very difficult to see them doing the jobs. We have several videos and things, recordings where they're working unsafely. It can be a dangerous job. It's very frustrating. I am suffering. My family is suffering.
Were you angry that there wasn't more media here? There weren't that many news trucks here. This was a very significant rally. People have marched over the Brooklyn Bridge. This is a major, major battle for working people. What do you say to mass media who seems to have blanked out this struggle of working men and women?
Absolutely. It's very frustrating. And although the news isn't showing up to our events, and though they aren't doing what they're supposed to do, we understand that the money is a key here for the news and everything, so they aren't broadcasting. They aren't broadcasting the ways we are trying to provide the world of who we are and what we're experiencing and what we're going through.
Well, maybe some of the politicians who go on these news programs, they're not going to be asked about this by the people who question them, but maybe they should just bring it up.
Yeah, the politicians, we greatly appreciate their support, but we definitely need a little more action from the politicians. We want help. We want them to support us. We want them to stand by us, and they're standing by. We need action. We need them to push these guys to give us a fair contract. That's all we really want is a fair contract, and we need these guys to move it forward.
We heard the talk from the politicians. Now we want them to walk that talk.
And we want to thank both of you.
Shanta
Jackson.
And Sunny Bennett.
Local 3! Local 3! Local 3!
So if you could please welcome Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer.
You never, ever let us down! But Charter Spectrum is letting us down! These companies are supposed to go like this. They can charge more, but that money is supposed to go back into the investments in their workers and to service. Is that happening here? No! This company, Charter Spectrum, they have a CDC right by their customers, they need to be accountable. And I'm not talking just about Charter. Verizon is also on notice. These companies think they are powerful enough to get away with mistreating workers, mistreating customers, and failing to live up to their agreements. We will show them they are wrong! Charter, Spectrum must do the right thing and give Local 3 a fair contract, and we'll keep standing on 96th Street and Broadway at the DW bus station where I've been until they do the right thing! Yeah. Thank you, Local 3! And we will keep fighting! Thank you!
And this was a rally of righteous anger of IBEW Local 3 workers.
We're waiting for this.
They marched over the Brooklyn Bridge. They've been out on strike for 6 months. You know what we've all got to do?
We've got to do is threaten Spectrum Charter Communications to revoke their franchise. And we have to tell people to threaten to quit Spectrum Charter and go to another carrier. Boycott Spectrum Charter.
Until they come to the table with a fair and equitable agreement for local IBEW Local 3.
We have to do that across the country because Charter is a national corporation in over 40 states, and unions throughout the entire country have got to put pressure on them, and this is one of the things they'll understand.
Support IBEW Local 3 workers, righteous anger. Make sure our brothers and sisters are back at work. And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And we're reporting from Foley Square. And you can find out more about the strike by going to newyorkcabletruth.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
The Australian people have long since believed that it is time for marriage equality.
Love is love unless you disagree. You can say no. Coalition for Marriage.
Hi, my name's Amelia. I'm volunteering for the Yes campaign for marriage equality.
Costs $122 million bloody dollars.
This is a vote about the lives and dignity of real people.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Egypt's rainbow flag crackdown balloons into mass arrests and a media blackout. Trump triples down on opposition to LGBTQ rights. And polls predict equality in Australia's postal marriage plebiscite. All that and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 7th, 2017. What began in Egypt with the detention of seven people for waving a rainbow flag at a concert by the Lebanese alternative rock band Mashru Leila, whose lead singer is openly gay, has mushroomed into mass arrests and a nationwide media ban on all things LGBT. More than 60 people have reportedly been taken into custody in the past week, several in their own homes. Many of the men have had to endure torturous and humiliating forced anal exams that authorities mistakenly believe provide proof of homosexual activity. Egypt's Supreme Council for Media Regulation issued an edict on October 6th calling same-gender love a sickness, and banning the appearance of homosexuals or their slogans in any media outlet, whether written, audio, or visual, except when they acknowledge the fact that their conduct is inappropriate and repent for it. Human Rights Watch issued a statement through its Middle East and North Africa director, Sarah Leah Whitson, condemning this vicious crackdown on a vulnerable group simply for waving a flag. Repression will not turn gay people straight. It will only perpetuate fear and abuse, she wrote. There's no possible objective or scientific reason to throw people in prison simply because of their sexuality. Same-gender sex is not specifically illegal in Egypt, but periodic crackdowns over the past several years use laws against immorality, inciting sexual deviancy, or debauchery to prosecute and imprison gay people. Mashru Leila joined this week's chorus of condemnation, charging in a statement that this crackdown is by no means separable from the suffocating atmosphere of fear and abuse experienced by all Egyptians on a daily basis, regardless of their sexual orientation.
In another of the world's queer hotspots, victims of the mass arrests of gay people in Azerbaijan that we first reported 2 weeks ago have detailed the depth of the abuse. One of the country's leading queer rights groups posted a statement on its Facebook page this week from one of the detainees, identified only as Hassan, who said that authorities beat him, falsely accused him of being a sex worker, and demanded information about his alleged clients. A joint statement from the Interior Ministry and Prosecutor General of the former Soviet Republic seemed to confirm that most or all of the detainees were accused of prostitution. It said that the 83 people arrested in the last 2 weeks of September were charged with offering unsolicited sexual services, violating public order, and spreading infectious diseases. The statement claimed that 32 of the detainees were diagnosed with various STDs, including HIV/AIDS. Homosexuality was decriminalized in Muslim-majority Azerbaijan in 2000, but discrimination and mistreatment of sexual and gender minorities are commonplace. An attorney said to be coordinating legal representation for those arrested told the Associated Press that at least 46 people have already been sentenced to between 10 and 30 days in jail for charges that included resisting arrest.
In happier news, lesbian and gay couples began getting hitched in Germany on October 1st when the country's marriage equality legislation took effect. Couples in existing civil partnerships that were originally created for them in 2001 also began converting those partnerships to marriage. The first marriage equality bill was introduced in the German parliament in 2000. The long and winding road to equality for one of Western Europe's last holdouts finally came in June when Chancellor Angela Merkel surprisingly ended her 12 years of resistance to allowing a free vote on the issue by her party MPs, thus assuring passage. She later revealed that meeting a lesbian couple who had successfully fostered 8 children changed her mind about allowing the free vote. Merkel herself, who said she still had a hard time with it, voted no. The marriage equality legislation also extends joint adoption rights to same-gender couples.
The Scottish Episcopal Church has joined the U.S. Episcopal Church in being sanctioned by the Global Anglican Communion for marrying same-gender couples. The Scottish Episcopal Church clergy and laity each voted overwhelmingly earlier this year to bless same-gender unions after civil marriage became legal in the country. Speaking to reporters this week, Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, the titular leader of the communion, confirmed that a primates meeting had decided to sanction the Scottish Church by barring their leaders from participating in important Anglican Communion events, similar to sanctions imposed on the U.S. Episcopals in 2016 for consecrating openly gay and partnered Bishop Gene Robinson and subsequently conducting church weddings for same-gender couples. The mostly queer-friendly Anglican congregations in North America and Western Europe have been at odds for years with what's called the Global South, branches of the church in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Global South leaders are generally biblical literalists who oppose any rights for LGBT people and any role for them in the church. Despite repeated concessions to those hardliner conservatives, the Anglican Communion has been slowly disintegrating for several years, and it seems unlikely that the widening divide between North and South will ever be resolved.
The administration of Republican U.S. President Donald Trump virtually declared war on LGBT people this week with religious freedom proposals that critics call licenses to discriminate, a reversal of the Obama Justice Department's assertion that LGBT people are protected from discrimination by federal civil rights laws, and doubling down on Trump's order to banish transgender people from the U.S. Armed Forces. Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued a memorandum on October 6th instructing Justice Department lawyers to honor claims of religious freedom violations over any civil rights claims by LGBT people, women, and others, writing that religious observance and practice should be reasonably accommodated in all government activity. Analysts say that the memo, supposedly an effort to protect the rights of people who oppose marriage equality on religious grounds, is so sweeping that it could allow not only individuals and businesses claiming that their faith compels them to deny service to LGBT people or anyone else they don't like, but government workers, public institutions, and even prisons. In a related but separate action this week, the Health and Human Services Department announced that more employers with religious objections to contraception would now be allowed under the Affordable Care Act to exclude birth control coverage. Expect a number of lawsuits to challenge both policy changes.
The Attorney General also solidified the DOJ's previously expressed policy position this week that existing federal law does not protect transgender people from discrimination. The Obama administration and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission argued in federal court cases for several years that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans discrimination based on sex, implicitly protects people from bias based on sexual orientation and gender identity. All three federal appeals courts that have considered the issue over the last two decades have ruled that bias against transgender workers is unlawful. A memo sent by Sessions to U.S. attorneys on October 4th insists that Title VII only bans bias based on biological gender and does not protect LGBT people. Sessions also reversed Obama-era guidelines earlier this year that protected transgender students.
Several lawsuits have already been filed against the Trump administration's plan to deny U.S. military service to transgender people. The Justice Department filed its first response this week in one case before the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. The 44-page brief insists that the president has the power to set military policy as commander-in-chief and compares the ban on transgender service to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that banned service by openly LGB people. Federal courts consistently upheld that policy until Congress finally repealed it. The conclusions of Pentagon studies a year ago prompted the Obama administration to support service by transgender enlistees and new recruits. But there were reports this week that Defense Secretary James Mattis is moving ahead with plans to implement Trump's total ban, including the expulsion of currently serving transgender troops, following the ongoing six-month Defense Department study revisiting the issue.
But finally, a transgender man in Botswana has won a 10-year battle to be legally recognized as male. The country's high court ordered the government this week to change the gender marker on his identity card from female to male. The justices ruled that officials had violated the plaintiff's rights to dignity, privacy, equality, freedom of expression, and freedom from discrimination and inhumane and degrading treatment. The man's identity is being kept secret for legal reasons, and probably for his own protection. Sexual and gender minorities can be jailed for up to 7 years in the Southern African country for unnatural offenses, and prejudice and abuse is routine. This is the Botswana government's second loss at the High Court in a queer-related case in recent years. The justices ordered officials to recognize and register an LGBT rights group as a non-governmental agency in 2014. In an understatement about the landmark ruling this week following his victorious 10-year legal battle, the unnamed trans man called it an immense relief.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 7th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Have you checked our website lately?
For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show,
log on to
thiswayout.org.
Hi, my name is John. I'm from the Labour Campaign for Marriage Equality. We're just wondering to see whether you've already voted in the postal plebiscite.
In hopes of hearing wedding bells, Australian activists are ringing doorbells for a victory in the marriage equality postal plebiscite. We've got an update on the progress of the campaign from Sydney correspondent Barry McKay. But first, let's send the queer campaigners down under some encouraging words. Here's a Rainbow Minute doubleheader celebrating the first legal marriages of same-gender couples in Spain and South Africa.
Tying the knot in Spain. Coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Emilio Menendez, a Spaniard, and Carlos German, an American, became the first gay couple to be married in Spain since the country's parliament passed a law legalizing such unions in July of 2005. A store window decorator and psychiatrist, respectively, they hugged each other, exchanged rings, and were declared united in matrimony. After the 10-minute civil ceremony, Menendez said, "We're normal people who love each other and want to be happy. The happiest day of our lives was when we fell in love with each other. We've been together for 30 years. There have been many wonderful days. Today is yet another wonderful day." Pedro Zerolo, a Spanish equal rights activist, called their marriage a triumph of common sense and the state of law. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Bill Lupoletti.
Out and Married in South Africa, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. After having been together for 9 years, Vernon Gibbs and Tony Halls became the first gay couple to legally wed in South Africa on December 1st, 2006. Wearing their Game Ranger outfits, they exchanged rings and were pronounced a married couple, with friends and curious onlookers present in the small hall. A year earlier, a decision by the Constitutional Court required the new marriage law. It went into effect the day before their historic wedding. Gibbs said the marriage gives them greater legal protection as well as better medical aid and pension benefits. But, practicality aside, he said, marriage means a lifetime commitment. It means to cherish, obey, love, honor. It means through sickness and health. All those relevant words I never thought would be for me. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios of WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Alan Brown.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
It's looking good, it's looking good, it's looking good, it's looking good, it's looking good.
Veteran activists will say it's never wise to count your ballots before they hatch, but things seem to be looking very good indeed for the Yes campaign in Australia's Marriage Equality Postal Survey. 57.5% of all paper ballots sent out had been returned by last week, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is running the poll, and that's already a higher number than expected. Although the ballots will not be counted until November, the Rupert Murdoch-owned Sky News TV channel conducted a poll of around 5,000 respondents. The encouraging results came in on October 2nd.
What we can show you now is a poll that is without doubt the strongest indication that Australia will overwhelmingly vote yes. More than 64% have sent back their ballot already, and they have voted yes. That's huge. That's in landslide territory, and that indicates this campaign may have already been won. 15.5% have sent back their forms already with a no vote. If that indeed is the result on November 15, it's a pathetic outcome for the no campaign. A further 6% still plan to vote yes, and roughly the same amount still plan to vote no, which, if they follow through on that, would take us to around 70% voting yes and 21% voting no. A small number, less than 6%, aren't going to participate. And just under 3% haven't received a ballot at all. 68% of those aged 51 to 64 have already voted yes, according to this survey. That's the strongest age demographic to have already voted yes. The next strongest is those aged 65 and over. Those aged 35 to 50 are close behind, followed by the 18 to 35-year-olds. So Forget the theory that young Australians would be driving the yes vote. It's actually right across the board, but particularly amongst those aged over 50 who are driving the yes vote. Maybe they know how to find the postbox.
Those demographics from Sky News TV's poll are surprising and the results sound great. But This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay takes a closer look at the campaign in the news and on the ground to see if the optimism is well-founded.
With things looking very hopeful, Yes campaign leader Tiernan Brady said on Sky News that although the figures looked encouraging, the Yes campaign had not yet claimed victory.
The figures are really good in terms of turnout, and we know that there are a million more votes in the post service waiting to go to the office. But there's no room for complacency. There are still millions of votes out there, and the rest of this campaign, we will not give up any single day making sure that everybody out there knows how important this is. This is a vote about the lives and dignity of real people. It's a simple, straightforward question, but it's an incredibly important one, which will have a profound positive change on the lives of so many Australians. So there's no complacency from this campaign. The Yes Equality campaign will continue on full speed because we want every single vote cast so that we can have a survey that reflects the values of the Australian people who have long since believed that it is time for marriage equality.
Undoubtedly, one of the highlights of the past couple of weeks was American rap singer Macklemore with Mary Lambert performing Same Love at the National Rugby League Grand Final in Sydney on the 1st of October, which was televised to a huge national audience. Sport arguably has more fervent followers per head of population in Australia than religion in the United States. Macklemore will be donating the Australian earnings of his song to the Yes campaign.
Swimming with the fear, underneath it's all the same love. About time that we raised up.
Although Conservative politicians had voiced their opposition to the song being performed at the grand final, it was generally well received by sports fans, and it was reported on Twitter and Facebook that at various pubs and clubs around Australia where the broadcast was screened, patrons booed at the No campaign ad which followed Macklemore and Lambert's performance. The No campaign ads have become more hate-focused. The latest Coalition for Marriage ad first appeared on Facebook the day before the grand final, laden with visuals of Facebook and Twitter text slurs which opponents of the No campaign had sent their direction. For the convenience of listeners, I'll read the text from the ad. Love is love. I genuinely hope someone kicks your teeth in. What a bunch of homophobic maggots. You prehistoric bigots. You sad, sad people. Utter clowns. You are disgusting. What a disgrace. You should be ashamed. Homophobic bigot. 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 Love is love, unless you disagree. You can say no. Coalition for Marriage. Perhaps on a more comedic note, Sydney-based veteran anti-LGBTIQ campaigner Fred Nile, whose activism goes right back to the 1980s in the early days of the Sydney lesbian and gay Mardi Gras, commented on the 4th of October that gays wanted to take over Australia with Same Love as their national anthem. Meanwhile, the door-knocking and phone-banking for the Yes campaign continues. I went out with a team of door knockers from the opposition Labor Party 2 weekends ago.
Hi, my name is John. I'm from the Labor campaign for marriage equality. We're just wondering to see whether you've already voted in the postal plebiscite.
Absolutely, actually, every one of the 9 of us have voted.
That's so fantastic, it's fantastic. Exactly. And you've already got a little sticker there.
Yes, too. Actually, we've already got stickers, yes.
And you've all voted yes.
All of us voted yes, absolutely.
Fantastic.
All 9 of us.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much.
No problem at all.
I also attended a phone banking session in the heart of Sydney last week, and many positive responses from those calls have also been reported.
Hi, my name's Amelia. I'm volunteering for the Yes campaign for marriage equality here in Sydney, and I'm making calls today to see if you support marriage equality. Oh, that's so great to hear. That's fantastic. So have you already voted in the postal survey?
An equality shop has been set up in the heart of Oxford Street, Sydney's gay golden mile, selling T-shirts, badges and giving out campaign posters and flyers to interested patrons. A wall of personal messages to Australia covers one side of the shop.
When people come in here, they all want to write messages about why marriage equality is important to them. And so we get them to write their own messages. It could be about their family members, it could be about their partner, it could be about their friends, their work colleagues. And we want them to write a personal message and put it on the wall, and they take photographs of it to just say how important this issue is to them and what
so
it means to them.
It's become a bit of a tourist attraction, hasn't it?
Yeah, we had a lot of Americans. I was in earlier this week, and there were some guys from New York here, and we've had people from all over the world. And especially when they come to Sydney and to Oxford Street, you know, this is a bit of a talking point. They come in here, and actually, you know, a lot of international people don't understand why we don't have marriage equality. So they come in here to find out why, and they want to support it as well, and they buy some souvenirs to take back home.
Former Labor Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who was in his leadership role in the 1980s, had some scathing words for the government at a talk at the National Press Club in Canberra on the 2nd of October.
It cannot produce a decision. It still requires a vote of the Parliament, whatever the result of the vote is. Costs $122 million bloody dollars. Can you imagine that a Prime Minister would make a decision in these stringent times, spending $122 million on a process that can't produce a result, when you could do so much to reduce the gaps, the Aboriginal people, education and so on? Without any question, the worst economic decision made by any Australian Prime Minister.
All remaining unposted ballots will need to be returned by the 7th of November, and the results will be announced on the 15th of November. If, as it would appear, the yes vote is in by an overwhelming margin, the government will then seek to legislate a bill in Parliament for the introduction of same-sex marriage in Australia. Senator Matthias Cormann spoke on the ABC's Drive program on the 3rd of October about the high participation rate in the postal survey.
I think it's not too optimistic to predict that we'll get well past 60%, hopefully we'll get past 70%. But, whatever the final number, I think, you know, it is very clear now that we will have a very credible participation rate when it's all said and done, and that the final outcome, the verdict of the Australian people through this process, will have a great authority, and the Parliament, of course, will act accordingly.
The exact details of the proposed bill are yet to be debated. There has been much discussion in the press as to the preservation of religious freedoms, an issue close to the No campaign's heart, and also especially with the conservative side of politics. Former arch-conservative Prime Minister John Howard, who sent troops to support George Bush's 2003 war in Iraq, took out a full-page ad in the Rupert Murdoch-controlled News Limited newspapers across the nation last week, calling for Australians to vote no to preserve religious freedoms amongst other conservative values. However, critics of the postal survey have said that there has been room for tampering and fraud, and this could be raised by either side of the campaign once the result is announced. Catherine Murphy, political editor of the Guardian Australia newspaper, commented on this on ABC Radio on the 18th of September.
It's hard to say how big the problems are at this point, because obviously it's just a bunch of anecdotes, but it is worrying, and I can predict with a certain amount of confidence that this will be used once a vote is cast in order to raise questions about whether or not that vote is legitimate.
The result will be, and the campaign has certainly been, a milestone for the LGBTIQ community in Australia, which has found itself being cast in the unexpected role of a political football. The same-sex marriage postal survey will also be remembered in Australian history as one of the major news stories for the second half of 2017. I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney for This Way Out.
It's looking good. It's looking good. It's looking good. It's looking good. And this just in, the campaign against marriage equality in Australia has gotten a shot in the arm from two powerful conservative sources. Archbishop Glenn Davies announced October 9th that the Anglican Diocese of Sydney had donated $1 million to promote a no vote. According to local queer activists, support for the no campaign is also coming from the U.S., including Republican-linked companies like the one that built apps for Donald Trump's presidential campaign and the National Rifle Association. If you missed Barry McKay's interview with queer activist mediator Anthony Venn Brown on how to survive a plebiscite, you can see the video of their whole conversation at thiswayout.org. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from John Dyer V and Michelle Yeader, produced by Steve Pride, Bill Lapuetti and Alan Brown, produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Barry McKay. The Ruddles performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2MTM Coonamble, New South Wales, Free Radio Edmonton, Edmonton, Alberta, KPFT, Houston, Texas, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now you all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Henry Kissinger is undoubtedly one of the most influential American politicians of the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st. Holding the positions of National Security Advisor under the administration of Richard Nixon and Secretary of State in the administrations of both Nixon and Gerald Ford, and a highly controversial recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, Kissinger has exerted enormous influence on American foreign policy. He's both celebrated by the American political establishment and media and reviled as a war criminal by many on the left. But on left and right, there tends to be almost a consensus about his approach, that he was an arch-realist. Yet in Kissinger's shadow, the long reach of America's most controversial statesman, published by Metropolitan Books, Greg Grandin argues that that's not accurate. Grandin, who teaches history at New York University, is the award-winning author of Fordlandia and Empire of Necessity. Greg, can you start by telling us why you're arguing that Kissinger is, in fact, not an arch-realist?
Well, because Kissinger himself, his writings reveal him to be the opposite of a realist. I think that there's a misrecognition about Kissinger that that speaks to a larger misrecognition about American foreign policy. I mean, people tend to speak about Kissinger in that polarity that they talk about U.S. foreign policy. It's either motivated by realism, you know, defense of interests and a projection of power, a kind of sober assessment of the realities of the world and the limits of American power. And on the other hand, idealism, that American power is put to defending American values or so-called American values, democracy and human rights. I think that polarity kind of obscures more than it reveals. And I think, and one of the reasons why I looked at Kissinger is exactly because of that, the misrecognition of him as a realist. If you go back and look at Kissinger's undergraduate thesis, which I did, it's a 400-page, you know, BA thesis at Harvard University. And it reveals him to be very influenced by a strand of romanticism, continental philosophy, that that was highly subjectivist, highly relativist. And the point isn't to use this thesis as a Rosetta Stone or a aha, you know, we've revealed Kissinger to be who really is because look what he wrote in the 1950s. But rather as a way of kind of setting out a template and then helping to understand his policies and his actions. He was very much influenced by a number of German philosophers or continental philosophers, Immanuel Kant and Oswald Spengler, that that held there was no such thing as reality other than the subjective interpretation that we as individuals bring to it. And Kissinger is very clear about that. And he's also very clear throughout in other writings. And the reason why this is important is because, again, it's not either the do a gotcha with Kissinger or blame Kissinger for everything that went wrong with U.S. foreign policy, but just as a way of establishing a continuity. And there's, for instance, there's often people often discuss Kissinger's realism as a break or opposed to the heady neoconservative adventurism, which drove us into the catastrophe in Iraq in 2003, Afghanistan in 2002, all of that kind of will to power subjectivism that we are an empire now, we make our own reality. And Kissinger actually said all of that and did all of that as a thinker and a policymaker much earlier. And just to sum up this little bit of a discussion, just to bring it back to concrete terms, I mean, Henry Kissinger bombed Cambodia and Vietnam for 5 years as the ultimate idealist, because he wanted the world to be not as it was, in which a small impoverished peasant country could actually withstand the weaponry of the strongest country in world history, but as it should be, in which the U.S. could bring its power to bear and break the will of third world countries. So that's the height of idealism.
And I want to talk to you much more about his underlying philosophy and also the bombing of Cambodia as we go on. And of course, there's a whole story, which we will get to, about how the new right viewed Kissinger. But why is it that he is remembered as being so different from the neoconservatives of the past, much more recent time, given that, as you say, he set a lot of these ideas in motion?
Well, I think there's reasons very particular to Kissinger's trajectory. And then there's the general fact that things have just gotten so catastrophic that people look back with nostalgia on his supposed gravitas and sense of purpose. Kissinger survived Watergate, and we could talk a little bit later on about how he did that and how he shouldn't have, how he was implicated in Watergate, and how Watergate is ultimately a foreign policy conspiracy and crime, not a domestic scandal. And then after Watergate and after the defense of the loss in Vietnam, Kissinger did preside over a period of retrenchment of U.S. power. He survived into the Ford presidency and as National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. And for all of his idealism, for all of his will to power subjectivism, he was chastised. He was chastened. There was a restriction of U.S. power after being kicked out of Southeast Asia. And he had to preside over that. And he had to reconstruct. I talk about how he's key in both presiding over the collapse of the old post-war national security state and then helping to reconfigure it on new footings after Vietnam. But Kissinger did talk about limits in the 1970s, you know, under the Ford administration. He did talk about interdependence. He did try to negotiate détente with the Soviet Union as a way of extracting and extricating the U.S. out of Southeast Asia. So there was history did impose limits on Kissingerism. And the neoconservatives, the first generation of neoconservatives, rose up attacking Kissinger. They hated Kissinger's supposed realism, his supposed amorality, his willingness to negotiate with the Soviet Union, particularly after the catastrophe in Vietnam. So the point is that and then what's interesting about it is that a lot of those neoconservatives, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, a lot of the lesser, more obscure neoconservatives, the Kagans and the Crystals and all of those folks, they rose up attacking Kissinger in exactly the terms Kissinger used in the 1950s to attack the Eisenhower administration. So the point is, if you look at the cycles of U.S. militarism, there's always a new generation of militarists who embrace the language of kind of will to power subjectivism as a way of attacking the current bureaucrats that are in power, the current technocrats. Now, oftentimes, you know, and then once they get in power, they themselves might be a little bit more cautious. But there is a cycle of militarism that Kissinger himself was both the agent of in the 1950s when he attacked Eisenhower for being too cautious, and then he was the target of after he survived the Nixon administration and moved into the Ford administration.
Well, let's talk more then about the ideas that undergirded his thought, and also in many ways one could see the shadows of, so to speak, on his successors on the right, and that is the notion of decline and will to power. A key thinker here is Oswald Spengler, who wrote the very influential book, Decline of the West. Tell us about that book and its influence on Kissinger.
Yeah, well, Oswald Spengler was a early 20th century historian, and historian lightly, because he actually rejected the empirical basis of history. He rejected the idea of a kind of a positive notion of looking at facts and analyzing the facts. And so historian / philosopher that wrote a very influential book that looked at the rise and fall of civilizations, used climactic language, talked about civilizations that were in their springtime and that were in the summer period and then the fall and then the winter. And Spengler is very influential among not just Kissinger, but he influenced Dick Cheney. He influenced a lot of these neoconservatives. One might think of him as a kind of low rent Nietzsche. Listeners might be more aware of that kind of German romanticism associated with Nietzsche. But Spengler is of that tradition, and it's a legitimate tradition. And it's a philosophical tradition in continental philosophy. And Kissinger, in his undergraduate thesis, revealed himself to be extremely influenced by it, but he rejected Spengler's pessimism. Spengler's analysis was based on the idea that all civilizations rise and all civilizations fall, and you can document the moment of decline when the bureaucrats take over, when the accountants take over, when the economists take over, when the poets and the priests and the warriors and the creative types that tap into the spirit, the zeit of a civilization, when they recede into the background, civilizations become over-bureaucratized, they become over-rationalized, they rely too much on fact and not enough on wisdom. And this is something that this analysis Kissinger embraced fully, but he rejected the pessimism. Spengler basically said that there was no way to avoid it, and that once the game theorists, once the accountants, once the economists, once the numbers crunchers, once the Nate Silvers show up, it's all decline, because they mistake mistake information for wisdom. Kissinger embraced the analysis but rejected the determinism. He said that individuals can, and by individuals he meant great men, great statesmen, right? For him, history took place in the realm of diplomacy, in the realm of international relations. So great men, great statesmen can intercede in history and bend the curve upward. So if you actually look at his analysis, the terms of the way that he criticized the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s, the Kennedy administration, or Robert McNamara as the head of the Department of Defense during the Vietnam War under JFK and LBJ, it was exactly in these terms that they know they can do something, but they forgot why they should do it. They've mistaken numbers for wisdom, information for knowledge. And these are the terms of his criticism to this day. I mean, you could open up his latest book that came out last year, World Order, and it's exactly the same thing. They know how to get somewhere, but they don't know why we're going. Why this is important is because this kind of notion of the importance of intuition in history, in diplomacy, the notion of hunches, the notion of action, is exactly the terms of the neoconservative pushed in the early 2000s.
But what's so interesting, though, in this is that reading these early writings that you cite in Kissinger's shadow, one is struck by the emptiness of the argument. It seems to be action for action's sake. He criticizes the technocrats and the bureaucrats for the how but not the why. But one is left wondering what his why is.
Well, there is no why, and that's what's fascinating about it. One of the things that Kissinger is associated with is with purpose. He'll use that word often, and a lot of this comes from this critique, this Spenglerian critique of technocracy, that we need to know not just how to do something, but why we are doing it. So this notion of purpose, we have to know where we want to be in 10 years' time. But if you actually dig it out, there is no there. There's an emptiness, exactly what you say. There's a hollowness. Kissinger is an extreme relativist. He is, I wouldn't say that he's amoral, but that morality is really based on power. He has a morality based on power, and there is a hollowness when he talks about purpose. When you excavate that concept, there is no sense. We could say that the purpose of a good society is, social justice, to bring about a decent standard of living for the majority of people. That would be purpose. But there is no purpose. And that brings back to exactly what you're saying, the circularity. Meaning is created through action. This, on this point, Kissinger is unfailingly clear. He said it in 1950, and he said it in 2015, that that because he believes that reality exists, he's not a solipsist. He doesn't believe that we as subjective beings have access to that reality other than our own, other than the meaning we bring to bear through act that's created through our action. So we always have to act. We always have, because it's through action that creates, that we create meaning, that we come to our sense of understanding of ourselves, that we come to our sense of our interests. There is no such thing as objective interest. Interests are created through action. And this creates an extremely dangerous circularity, you know, circular kind of reasoning, that we have to act in order to avoid inaction. Power creates purpose, and our purpose is basically the projection of power. It's exactly that. And again, I would say that these are, you know, if you peeled back the layers of neoconservative justification of why we had to go into Iraq, setting aside the specific fallacies of weapons of mass destruction and democracy and all of that nonsense. It was ultimately a sense to give ourselves meaning, that we had become flabby as a civilization, that we had lost the will to act. And if you lose the will to act, then you won't be able to act when you need to act. So therefore, we have to act all the time in order to maintain that will. That's the neoconservative will to power and will to purpose.
Greg Grandin is my guest. He's the author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman, and that's published by Metropolitan Books. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Another influence on Kissinger was Hegel, but correct me if I'm wrong, but he does not appear to be the kind of right-wing Hegelian like Francis Fukuyama, who sees history moving toward any kind of end. As you've just been saying, there's no sort of master plan that the universe is trying to direct us to, or that we should be directing things to ourselves beyond just this impulse to action.
Yeah, I mean, he was a Hegelian in the sense that a whale, I would say a soft Hegelian in the sense that he did have a kind of dialectical sense of interconnectedness. He was able to kind of allow him to analyze the bigger picture, see how one thing over here is connected to something over there. And I think that gave him a leg up among other foreign policy careerists in the United States foreign policy establishment. But you're right, he didn't believe he is ultimately a nihilist, and there is, if you read his undergraduate thesis in the 1950s, and again running out, and then his other writings throughout the 1960s and 70s up to this day, there is a sense of the meaninglessness of existence, and there is a world weariness. You know, if you read his undergraduate thesis, it comes across a little Sartrean, a little existentialist, that we have a, you know, that we have a responsibility to act, but you know that, you know, you can't root that responsibility in any larger moral order, or any, the history is not, you know, being guided by any kind of larger logic. And that's why I call it a kind of imperial existentialism. There's a way in which the justification for power is built into this kind of world-weary shrug. You know, there's nothing one could do to make things much worse because life is suffering and, you know, birth leads to death. You know, these are all phrases straight out of his undergraduate thesis. So, you know, what's interesting is that a lot of the new left anti-imperialists and anti-war activists in the 1950s, late 50s or 60s, 70s, were very much influenced by existentialism. And again, you think of somebody like Sartre. What's unique about Kissinger is that he put his existentialism to justify empire and war rather than fight against it.
Well, what's so interesting is how Kissinger seems to be both shaping his times but also a man of his times. And you write what might seem like a very surprising description of him, saying that he had a new left mind with old right morals. And yeah, this is in relation to what you had been talking about earlier about his critique, you know, following Spengler and others, romantic idealists, against the bean counters, against the technocrats who've taken over, and that there's this need to turn back to instinct, to spirit, against this over-rationalized society. Now, in many ways, that actually reads as something straight out of the New Left at the time,
yeah,
its critique of the liberal establishment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's what I was trying to get at. You know, there's a, you know, all of that subjectivist, you know, romanticist tradition in continental philosophy has a, you know, as you mentioned, has a left wing variant. I mean, I don't want to get too thick in the weeds, but, you know, reading Kissinger's undergraduate thesis, I felt like I was reading Horkheimer and Adorno's, you know, Dialectic of Enlightenment, you know, Critique of Instrumental Reason. You know, there's, and there was certainly a critique of bureaucracy. At one point, he has a great essay, I mean, a great line in an essay in the 1960s where he's, I mean, you're speaking in Berkeley, and so it sounded like Mario Savio. Mm-hmm. It was it was a critique of serving the machine. You know, it was just like, you know, it's that, you know, so there is a way in which his critique, you know, is very harmonizes with a certain, and that's what I think is what is interesting about him. I mean, but again, the point of this study was to use Kissinger to go beyond Kissinger, right? Because every other study of Kissinger obsesses about the man, right? He eclipses his own context. He, you know, and usually it's a way, and usually they talk about Kissinger as somehow standing askew to American exceptionalism, right? He, the reason for his success is because he, you know, he was a German realist, and, you know, and all, you know, all of his biographers say this. I mean, even Christopher Hitchens, very damning The Trials of Henry Kissinger, basically said that the reason why Kissinger was a war criminal is because he violates American values. But the point of my book is to show how he's actually the quintessential American in all sorts of ways. One, the implicit argument of my book is that American exceptionalism is a will to power subjectivism. So Kissinger harmonizes very, very nicely with that. Hence, the neoconservatives aren't an aberration, but in some ways a fulfillment of American exceptionalism. But also Kissinger's career and his personal advancement, his ability to self-create and be all things to all people, is also a quintessential American characteristic. He rises up through the meritocracy, the post-war meritocracy. He fills in the vacuum with the collapse of the Eastern establishment, the WASP Eastern establishment. Paul, you know, the thing about Kissinger people say is that he was uncomfortable with all of the modern politics, that he would have been better off, you know, in mid-next 19th century cabinet diplomacy where he didn't have to answer to the press or a public. You know, that's complete nonsense. Kissinger cultivated the press. He was a creation of the press, and he was able to use the press, and the same thing with the public. He is the quintessential product of post-war meritocracy, and he was able to use the foreign policy establishment as that establishment democratized. You know, and I'm using that word democracy in a value neutral way. You know, but after World War II, and particularly after the 1960s, the national security establishment opens up to new people like Kissinger, and Kissinger is a perfect example of that. And that partially explains the endurance of the national security state. It's not just to serve the interests of Halliburton. It's because it gives a lot of people a good job.
Well, given his ability coming at the right time, as you say, as shifts were happening as well, but also his enormous ambition and his ability to sway the press and actually to appeal to intellectuals, including those who would be left-leaning. You know, you were talking about how we should see him as situated very much in his time and within the zeitgeist of his time. What were the implications of his ability to woo those who you would think would be clearly his opponents?
Yeah, on both sides, right? On both sides of the ideological divide. We can come back and talk about the specifics, but, you know, Kissinger is a right-wing defense intellectual in 1950s that is pushing the debate to the right, but he's very tied to the middle establishment. He's very tied to centrist Republicans. He's an advisor to Nelson Rockefeller in 1968. He thinks his career for a brief moment, his career is over because the Democrats are imploding, and he had ties to the Democrats, and he was an advisor to different Democratic administrations. But he also saw the nomination of Richard Nixon as the end of the evaporation of the center, and then he's able to make his peace. The thing about Kissinger is, what's fascinating about him is that, you know, every major post-war defense intellectual, policymaker and intellectual, you know, be they liberal or conservative, Arthur Schlesinger, George Kennan, eventually breaks, if only temporarily, with the national security establishment, you know, over Vietnam, over the arms race, over Reagan, whatever. They feel like, all right, this is a step too far, you know, we've unleashed a monster, we've got to rein it in. Not Kissinger. What's interesting about Kissinger is that he, with every lurch to the right, from, you know, from World War II to the present day, he makes his peace, he lurches with it. So that, I think, is also instructive. And again, it's not to focus on his, you know, whatever peculiar mix of ambition and venality leads him to make his peace with first Nixon and then Reagan and then the Bush administration. But I think it's also instructive because the country has moved to the right. So it does reveal a larger tendency. But he was also good with the left and liberals. You know, and Nixon was constantly sending him to basically keep the liberals quiet, keep the intellectuals happy. You know, he was meeting constantly with Arthur Schlesinger, even as he and Nixon were gloating, you know, in the Oval Office about breaking America's faith in the establishment. He was telling Schlesinger, you know, I really would resign, but the American public, you know, that would really, the American public would lose faith in the institution of the presidency if I were to leave. I'm the only thing that, you know, stops the really bad people from taking power. And Schlesinger was buying it up until the last minute, you know, lapping it up until the last minute. So Kissinger was able to be all things to all people. He was also a useful emissary to the rising new right for Nixon. Nixon was constantly dispatching him to California to talk to Bob Hope and to talk to Ronald Reagan and say, look, You know, how can you say there's no difference between Humphrey and Nixon? If it wasn't for Nixon, we wouldn't have been, you know, we wouldn't have had the invasion of Cambodia. We wouldn't have had the invasion of Laos. So foreign policy becomes subordinated to this kind of domestic politics like never before. And Kissinger plays a key role in it.
That's the voice of historian Greg Randon. We'll return with him in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Greg Randon about Henry Kissinger. Randon is the author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. That's published by Metropolitan Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Greg Randon teaches history at New York University. One could spend hours and hours of an interview talking about the many crimes of Henry Kissinger. And as you say, Christopher Hitchens wrote a polemic making the case of Kissinger being a war criminal. You're taking a different angle in all of this and not seeing Kissinger as so all-powerful, plucking him completely out of the context in which he operated. But of all the many interventions that Kissinger was instrumental in, and one can, you know, the range goes from Asia to Africa to Latin America, the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile, Operation Condor, East Timor, Bangladesh, Cyprus, Uruguay. The list is enormous. But in Kissinger's Shadow, you focus particularly on Nixon and Kissinger's secret bombing and then public war against Cambodia, which was a neutral country during the Vietnam War. Why is Cambodia so important in the story beyond being obviously such an atrocity?
Well, because the secret bombing of Cambodia in some ways is the linchpin to the sequence of causes and effects that lead to the downfall of Nixon and leads to the escalation in Vietnam. So we alluded to this earlier, where in late 1968, Kissinger sees the center of the political establishment evaporate. The Democrats are fighting it out in Chicago. The Republicans nominate Nixon, who at the time was seen as a dangerous right-wing, irresponsible, resentful, you know, candidate compared to Nelson Rockefeller. But Kissinger acts very quickly once the Republicans nominate Nixon. He lets the Nixon people know that he could use his contacts in the outgoing Johnson administration to let them know what's going on in Paris with the peace talks. The Johnson administration was trying to extricate itself from Vietnam. It was engaged in unofficial talks with North Vietnam in Paris, and the Nixon campaign feel was that a bombing halt or an announcement of the announcement of formal peace negotiations would benefit Nixon's rival, the Democrat Humphrey. Vietnam was the key issue in that 1968 race. So Kissinger had ties, including with Richard Holbrooke and others involved in those negotiations, and he passed information on to the Nixon campaign. The Nixon campaign then used that information to tell South Vietnam to hold on, don't agree to any deal. You'll get a better deal with us. And that led to the collapse of the talks. South Vietnam balked, right? This was right on the eve of the election. Nixon won the election. And then in reward, or I don't know if there was a quid pro quo, but he appoints Nixon national security advisor, and not just any national security advisor. Nixon's paranoia segued very nicely with Kissinger's view of diplomacy, and he tasked Kissinger with creating the most powerful national security agency council in up to that date, to wrench power, take power away from state, take power away from the Department of Defense, and concentrate it in the White House, in the National Security Council. But once Nixon won, they had to figure out Nixon ran on a peace platform. He said he would end the war, but they had sabotaged the election, the negotiations. So they couldn't begin to bomb North Vietnam right away. Nixon and Kissinger thought that the best way to force Hanoi back to the negotiating table was to punish them through acting like the famous madman, right? That you act in a way to convince your adversary that you don't know what they would do, so you would force them to negotiate. But the public will was very much against bombing North Vietnam right after the election, so they began bombing Cambodia. And they began bombing Cambodia in secret because they were afraid of the domestic backlash. That secret protocol that they came up to bomb with Cambodia was called Operation Menu. It didn't just have to be top secret, it had to be completely secret. They came up with a completely deceitful way of carrying out the bombing so nobody would know about the bombing. But it created a sense of paranoia within the White House that led to all of the wiretapping, that led to all those black bag operations, that eventually led to the creation of the plumbers that was responsible for breaking into the Watergate Hotel. When Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers, that had nothing specifically damning about Nixon. It was just a history of the Vietnam War from the 1940s up until LBJ, up until the Johnson administration. But Kissinger was sure that Ellsberg had information about Cambodia, about the bombing of Cambodia. So he goaded Nixon into going after Ellsberg. I mean, if you go listen to the tapes, it's fascinating. Kissinger seemed to key his comments about Ellsberg, because he and Ellsberg actually went back. I have a whole chapter in the book about the weirdly symmetrical relationship and career of Ellsberg and Kissinger. They're kind of like, they've kind of feed off of each other in different ways. Ellsberg for good, Kissinger for evil. Kissinger starts cranking up all of Nixon's various resentments. It's actually kind of fascinating. He paints Ellsberg as this kind of promiscuous, ubermensch that was voracious in his appetites, that was highly sexualized, you know. And there's one line which I just love because Kissinger tells Nixon, and you know, he married a very rich girl. You know, and you know, Nixon, the kind of resentful outsider, you know, you can just see him, you know, working up into a froth. And it's out of this that they set up the plumbers, which leads to Watergate. Now, Watergate is now remembered as a completely domestic crime, but it was really about Cambodia. And this is, I use it in the book to show the way which foreign policy and militarism get effaced from public debate in the United States. So the point is, Cambodia, the bombing of Cambodia, 100,000 civilians dead, creating the vacuum that leads to the rise of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, is all basically for nothing. This was all about trying to force North Vietnam back to the bargaining table. By the time they end the war in 1973, or by the time the U.S. Negotiates its exit in 1973, it did so on terms that were basically on the table in 1968. So 5 years of senseless slaughter and destruction of numerous countries in Southeast Asia for absolutely nothing. And the only thing that it did was it aligned Henry Kissinger more closely with the national security state. So the story plays a central role for all of those reasons.
What's so interesting is that Cambodia also offers a way of seeing how Kissinger responded to criticisms about the ultimate effects of U.S. foreign policy. As you were saying, the massive bombing of Cambodia then ultimately providing the ground for the killing fields of the Khmer Rouge, the rise of Pol Pot. And it's very interesting because central to Kissinger's way of seeing the world, he rejected the notion of cause and effect, that, you know, the U.S. might create the conditions, horrendous as they were by themselves, that then would lead to these further atrocities, and that instead his approach was to study situations not by looking at cause and effect, but by looking at analogy, which of course is such a slippery thing because, you know, you have a wide choice of what you decide is the appropriate analogy.
Yeah, it's always Neville Chamberlain in 1938, and it's never Nixon and Kissinger in 1968 or 69, you know. And this goes back, this speaks to the earlier discussion about Kissinger's philosophy of history and philosophy of diplomacy and the responsibility of statesmen to intervene, to act in history, and that statesmen have a responsibility to slow the decline, to move the civilization back from the precipice through action, through will. And it's very clear, Kissinger says that, you know, one of the things that paralyze politicians is too much information. One of the other thing that paralyzes a statesman is too much of an adherence to causality, to the notion of cause and effect. Cause and effect is like a chain that will imprison statesmen. If they look back and see how an action, you know, a past action led to today's catastrophe, how the invasion of Iraq in 2003 led to the rise of ISIS, it'll paralyze them from taking action today, in the present, and it's the statesman's responsibility to act. And this is clear in when Cheney is, you know, occasionally called on the carpet for, you know, for creating the conditions for the current catastrophe in the Middle East. He's very clear on this. He says that, look, we could debate what happened in 2003, whether it was right or wrong or not, but there's a crisis right now, and it's our responsibility to act. That is pure Kissingerism. That is Kissinger's very well articulated and well understood. This isn't kind of an instinctual understanding of history, like, you know, most American statesmen who mobilize analogies in order to justify militarism. I'm sure they're not very aware of the philosophical foundation in which they do that. Kissinger is very highly aware of the stakes and understanding history as analogy and what history teaches, but it teaches by analogy. And that if we focus too much on cause and effect, we will become paralyzed. I mean, this is the man who basically created the
selling the arms race in the Middle East for petrodollars, right? And, you know, built up the Shah, built up Saudi Arabia, gave those two countries anything that they wanted as long as they used their petrodollars to buy U.S. weaponry and, laying the groundwork for the current disaster and impasse in the Middle East. So there's a clear cause and effect. In the book, I try to look at Cambodia because Kissinger gets very agitated whenever Cambodia is brought up. And I think the reason why he gets agitated, not because, ultimately his actions led to the deaths of millions of people, but because Cambodia is hard to deny, right? It's almost impossible. People like William Shawcross, the journalist, or Ben Keenan, the historian at Yale, have fairly established the ways in which Kissinger's bombing Cambodia didn't create the Khmer Rouge, but created the conditions in which the Khmer Rouge could take power. And it's that for anybody who actually looks at the case, it's such a pushback against Kissinger's philosophy that it rankles him, and one of the reasons why he gets very upset and agitated when Cambodia is raised.
Historian Greg Randon is my guest. He is the award-winning author of many books, including Fordlandia. His latest is Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman, and we're discussing that book in this hour. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain. So Kissinger both was very responsible, of course, for creating the reaction, ultimately, of many Americans to the adventures, if one can use that word, in Vietnam, in Cambodia. But you also argue that he was a sort of pivotal figure in the post-Vietnam War order in America, that Americans, after all of that, did not want to commit American troops to such foreign policy excursions in the future.
Yeah, I mean, Kissinger is a fascinating figure for a number of reasons. One, I look at the way that he presides. His actions with Nixon, Cambodia, the public backlash against Cambodia, the reaction to Vietnam leads to the breakup of the old national security state. And what I mean by that is that coming out of World War II, up until about the late 1960s, the mid-1960s, the old national security state was run by elite consent, elite planning, bipartisan consensus, and some, if not public support, then at least public acquiescence to U.S. foreign policy in the Cold War. Kissinger isn't responsible for the complete breakup of that. Obviously, that started early under Johnson, and Nixon's responsible. But his actions, particularly in Cambodia, but elsewhere, accelerated the breakup. But Kissinger, because he survives Watergate, because he moves on into the Ford administration, he's instrumental in reestablishing what I call a new national security state, a restored national security state, able to move forward in a post-Vietnam War. And I look at three things in particular. One is that the increasing reliance on covert activity, even as Congress and the press becomes much more interventionist in trying to limit the imperial presidency, limit covert actions. Kissinger comes up with ways of bypassing that. The other thing is Kissinger is key in using foreign policy to leverage that domestic polarization, right? So the way he's able to use foreign policy to win over the right, to win over Ronald Reagan, foreign policy becomes almost completely subordinated to domestic maneuvering. This is nothing particularly new, right? All presidents going back to George Washington use foreign policy for domestic benefits, but it becomes much more central, much more of a central axis in domestic politics, to the point where I would argue that the valence completely shifts in the 1960s and 70s, where foreign policy, it's the only way to explain the insanity of today's foreign policy is not to understand it in terms of interests or objective power, but one, ideology, and two, the way it plays into domestic polarization and politicians use it. Kissinger was key, and then this continues. And the third thing is more the philosophical that we talked about, the philosophical dimensions. But then, after and outside of power, as both a lobbyist and a consultant. Kissinger Associates is one of the most powerful private consultancies in the world. It was key in brokering, for instance, the privatization of Latin American industry in the 1980s and 1990s. But also as a Republican intellectual, Kissinger has been central in pushing the remilitarization of the Gulf. He was in favor of the first Gulf War. He was in favor of the second Gulf War. And so there is no distinction between neoconservatives and Kissinger when it comes to the disaster in the Persian Gulf.
And yet, one of the interesting parts of the story is how in the 1970s, the emergent new right, and especially Ronald Reagan, who ran for president in 1976, set themselves up as representing a kind of revived, spirited right against the technocratic legacy of Henry Kissinger.
The bureaucratic, Kissinger was, I mean, that's the irony, that's the Hegelian irony of this whole story, is that, you know, the terms in which the new right attacked Kissinger, and Reagan in 1976 attacked Kissinger more than he attacked Gerald Ford. He basically treated, you know, Henry Kissinger as if he was in charge and treated Ford. He always mentioned Kissinger's name first, right, when he talked about Kissinger and Ford, attacking detente. And again, Kissinger, having survived Watergate, having survived Vietnam, was constrained, and he believes the real world does exist, even if he doesn't believe that we don't have access to it other than through our subjective action. But he believes there are limits to human action. He believes there are limits to U.S. power, and he witnessed it firsthand in Southeast Asia, and the new right rose up attacking those limits, attacking that notion so in some ways, Reagan was one step further along on the road to existential, you know, insanity that they do away with reality, right? Like Kissinger didn't believe that the reality existed, but we didn't have access to it. But then you get to Reagan and the neoconservatives, and you know, we create our own reality, and it is fascinating the way the neocons basically attack Kissinger with the same exact terms that Kissinger attacked Eisenhower and McNamara in the 50s and 60s.
Where would you place Henry Kissinger within the spectrum of the right? You quote him saying that given the choice between order and injustice on the one hand and disorder and justice, he'd pick the former, which is, you know, a classic position of conservatism. And yet, as you say, he also presented himself as holding the center against the right.
I think that was just part of the spiel that he used for liberals and the left, that, you know, I lived through Weimar Germany, you know, you don't know when the revolution comes, it's not going to be led by Tom Hayden and the Peace Quakers. It's going to be led by the real, you know, nasty men. And, you know, but it turns out that Kissinger made his peace with those real brutal men at every step of the way, right? I mean, he thought Donald Rumsfeld was one of the most, he described Donald Rumsfeld in the 1970s as one of the most despicable men in government, the way that Rumsfeld and Cheney teamed up to undercut his negotiations with the Soviet Union under, you know, for arms limitation, you know, but by 2001, 2002, there he was, you know, cheering Rumsfeld and Cheney on into Iraq. So, you know, I would say, rather than situating him in a fixed point on the American right, I would see the way that his whole movement, reflects the contours of the movement of the United States towards the point where we are today.
Well, let me end by asking you about something which you don't write extensively about in Kissinger's Shadow, and that is his economic influence. To what degree does he leave us with a shadow over those questions?
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways to think about that question. One, he's key in creating the whole petrodollar regime, you know, the whole trading, you know, not at first. It was a gradual policy. But it's Nixon and Kissinger who basically give Gaddafi the green light to nationalization, and they accept slightly higher oil prices in 69-70. In 72-73, during the energy crisis, they flail around, but Kissinger eventually comes up. He's among a group of elites that come up with the sense that, well, you know, maybe we could actually take advantage of these high energy prices as a way of recycling petrodollars back into the U.S. financial system and into the U.S. Arms industry, which was taking a little bit of a hit after the end of the Vietnam War. So the whole kind of neoliberal transition to finance capital brokered through petrodollars, Kissinger is absolutely key. You know, I try not to go in too much into that because that is a bit thick in the woods. And yeah, and then the second thing is that Kissinger's role as a consultant, you know, Kissinger Associates is one of the most powerful private consultants. Remember, Kissinger was supposed to be the head of the 9/11 commission that Bush appointed him for. He was the first chair of the 9/11 commission. But then when some of the widows family of the victims demanded that he release his client list because they were afraid that Kissinger Associates had too close ties with Saudi Arabia, he refused. And he stepped down and then appointed somebody else. Kissinger Associates was key in brokering a lot of the privatization of Latin American industry. It's often not remembered that Kissinger was absolutely essential in negotiating NAFTA under George H.W. Bush. And then once Clinton was in office, he helped Clinton get it through Congress. He advised Clinton on how to get it through Congress. So, again, thinking beyond his own personal interests and success and luxury, I think he is a central figure in understanding the current political economy.
Greg Grandin is the author of a number of books, including Fordlandia and The Empire of Necessity. His latest book is Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. That's published by Metropolitan Books, and he teaches history at New York University. Greg, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sasha. It's always great. Always wonderful to be on.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.